going from venue to venue. So, well, I don't know, it could have been, yeah, listen.
Let's talk a little bit about your intro.
Principles and Liberty, number 36. It's April 10th, and I'm finally able to get down to transcribing the recording of the 2009 Continental Congress informational meeting taking place in Seattle on the University of Washington campus. I'm going to put the whole thing in here, which is going to be several hours long, so be aware of that. This is a long one. And you know, feel free to copy this and share it around all you want. We want to make this information as widely available. We had about 47 people show up, which, you know, I don't know, I guess is what I can expect for the short time of announcement that I came into the picture into. And it's just it's hard to get everybody from their own camps to cross-pollinate and look at other camps. People, I know specific people who did not come to this meeting because they had worked for Ron Paul very hard and lost, and they were burnt out, and they were upset, and they were distraught, and they didn't want to bother with it anymore. And I can totally relate, having done this these kinds of things for many, many, many years and had needed breaks. There's only so much energy. But I think you'll pick up some good stuff here. There's especially at the very end, there's some interesting stuff that Bob reveals about his plans. But the whole story of Bob's stuff is something that people have to be aware of. And, of course, they're never going to see it on the media unless they, you know, they have to look for it themselves and find it in the on the Internet. So here it is. I'm making it available here. And, of course, it's available at Bob's central website. So I'll put links in the notes. And enjoy.
Confronting them and getting no answer, you know.
Constitution. What are you talking about? Okay. All right, Sandy.
Should we get started?
Don't worry, it's okay.
Yeah. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for showing. My name is Sandy Staub. I am the volunteer that got this room for Bob. And I'm glad you all came. And tell your friends what I plan to do at the end of this. I'm recording this with an audio recorder, and I'll be adding it to that page that I sent out on emails to everyone. I have cards here you guys can pick up on your way out, take as many as you like. I might as well get rid of them tonight. And the URL on here will take you to that blog page that will reference you to Bob's websites and any news I find out about this on this meeting, the recordings, any videos we have, whatever. I'll post them there, post links, and you'll be able to contact me as well. My background is pretty much on my podcast. You can just look at that, and it's an open book. I wanted to first open us up in prayer, and then I'll introduce Steve Pigeon, who I'll introduce later. So let's open in prayer. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for enabling us to meet here tonight. Give Bob the words that he needs to have to pass his message on and give us ears to hear. Lord, we thank you that you are the authority that gives us rights that man cannot take away. And we pray that you would have mercy on this nation and that we would be mindful of the gravity of what's going on and your work in it. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So Steve Pigeon here is a good friend of mine who is a lawyer. He grew up in Alaska. He's speaks fluent Russian. He's a concert pianist and a very talented guitarist and an amazing man who understands concepts and liberty. And he, I nominated him as a delegate to this Continental Conference, Congress. And so he's a nominee. Being a nominee, I thought he should be the one to introduce Bob. So, Steve Pigeon.
Thank you, Sandy. Well, I think as many of us know, the Constitution and our constitutional republic has never been in greater jeopardy. just this past recent week. We've seen the creation of an international currency. We've seen the creation of an international bank that is expected to govern our banking and our corporations. We've seen the nationalization of our banks. We've seen the nationalization of the auto industry and a reach from the federal government that is, in any other term, has to be construed as ultra-virus, way beyond the constitutional authority granted to it. And, of course, those who sit in the realms of power in those marbled and columned buildings in Washington, D.C., sit there by one reason and one reason only, by benefit of the ordinance known as the United States Constitution. For them to be there for any other reason is ludicrous. They would have no business being there if it were not for that document. But now the Constitution is under egregious and grievous threat. It's beyond life support. We're now into the coma phase. And so when we look at this as Americans, we're asking ourselves the question, is there anything we can do? Is there anything we can do that will strengthen and rebuild the constitutional republic? And when you're asking yourself that question, I think one answer has to be in front of all of us. That whatever it is we're going to do, we need to do it by lawful means. Because ultimately, we are the people of law. That's how this nation was created, and it stands for the proposition of the rule of law, which is the proposition that Bob is bringing forth today, and it is the proposition by which we act in accordance with the rule of law, because history will come to judge our legacy. And our legacy must be one of righteousness and correctness and legality. Now, when you're asking yourself the question, what can be done? The Constitution has a certain rubric in it and a spirit in it that allows us to step forward to support the constitutional framework. It's self-contained, self-proving, if you will. And that self-proving has been the life work of Bob Schultz. Now, he's been at this endeavor for over 30 years. And in this endeavor, he is pursuing the restoration of the constitutional republic. And bear in mind, my friends, that we're not talking about the constitutional democracy. A democracy is only one component of the national state. The national state is a republican form of government, with a small r, that has democratic components to it. And within the Constitution, and as a later addition to the Constitution in 1789, it was argued for a Bill of Rights. And in that Bill of Rights, Congress began with the First Amendment. The First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. But the clause we're going to be speaking about tonight is going to be contained in the remainder of the First Amendment, which is why we're glad that all of you have attended this particular seminar. So without any further ado, the man who founded We the People Foundation in 1997, which was the successor organization to two previous state organizations, a man that has over 115 statewide litigation lawsuits and over 90 federal lawsuits, who is establishing what we in the legal business call an extended line of case precedents in order to enforce our freedoms under the First Amendment, freedoms which have to be construed as precious and now endangered. The man who has done this and who has put his life work into it, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Bob Schultz.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you very much for coming, everyone. Why don't we start out with a pledge to the Constitution of the United States of America, if we could stand. I mean it. You have a copy here. I pledge allegiance to the Constitution of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. So when was the Constitution adopted? Don't hear it yet.
1787.
When was the Bill of Rights added? 91. Okay. Who does the Constitution govern? It governs the government. We decided we need a government to secure our rights, rights that are individual, unalienable, endowed by the Creator. Income from the state, income from the majority, they're endowed by the Creator. And we decided we needed a government to protect us one from another to secure these rights. And so we have set up a federal government. By the terms of the document, and you can't really talk about the Constitution without talking about the Declaration of Independence. They are inextricably intertwined. The Declaration is the charter, the Constitution, the bylaws. The Declaration lays out some essential principles. We just mentioned one. Popular sovereignty is another essential principle underlying our system of governance. Sovereignty rests with the people here. That is not true anywhere else on the globe. Everywhere else, somebody other than the people is sovereign. So popular sovereignty is an underlying essential principle. We can't separate these two documents. So we've set three branches up. We've established a constitutional republic. The government is a servant government. By the terms of the document, we prohibit and restrict and mandate that the government do certain things. They shall do this, and they are prohibited from doing that, and so forth. It's a rule book to govern the government. Is the government violating the Constitution? Anybody?
Absolutely.
All right, specifically, what clause, what prohibition, what restriction, what mandate is the government, the federal government, the elected officials, violating?
Money.
We have money clauses in here. The federal government is clearly violating the money clauses. The evidence strongly supports the fact that the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional. I can't find any authority in here for the federal government to give or lend public money or credit to a private entity for a decidedly private purpose, which is what they're doing these days. What other prohibitions or restrictions are being violated by the federal government?
Article 5,
meaning?
Refuse to call a convention.
They refuse to call a convention. I don't know that that's a violation. They can do it if they want to. Let's hope that they don't call a constitutional convention at the federal level. That could be disastrous under the these days. What are the specific prohibitions, restrictions, and mandates besides the money clauses? Are there any other violations?
Taxation.
The direct unapportioned tax on labor violates the taxing clauses. Clearly, the facts support that claim. What other violations? Yes.
I say there are two. One is the prohibition against a religious test for positions of trust, and the second one being the habeas corpus. There are two specific criteria for suspending that, and I don't believe either of those criteria are met.
Okay, what other violations? Yes, sir.
McCain-Fine vote would be a violation of free speech.
Free speech?
A host of anger-honors and those kind of laws.
Yes, yes.
Wireless searches and seizures.
We have a developing police state. We have USA Patriot Act and its progeny violating the so-called privacy clauses, authorizing, for instance, the executive to come into our homes and copy our hard drives and leave without telling us that they were there. What other violations? Yes?
state and federal governments in innumerable ways, like ultra-various commerce powers. They have tried to usurp any number of private interests and affairs under the so-called Commerce Clause, which is just a flagrant abuse of the terms and the constraints that were implied in that clause.
What about the War Powers Clause? I mean, the founders, the evidence strongly shows, clearly shows, that the founders worked very hard to make sure that the decision to apply the armed forces of the United States in hostilities overseas would never rest with one man, the president, but would always rest with our representatives in Congress. And the last time they declared war, of course, dozens of times since World War II, we've applied the armed forces of the United States in hostilities overseas, but without a declaration of war by Congress. What about the Natural Born Citizen Clause? The evidence now strongly suggests, I mean, Mr. Obama has refused every attempt to provide evidence that he satisfies the Natural Born Citizen Clause. Other violations of the Constitution. Yes, ma'am.
Full faith and credit clause. The refusal to recognize licensed marriages in some states by the federal government.
Okay.
Same-sex partners, for instance.
Anyone else? Yes.
I don't see anything in the Constitution that authorizes the federal government to oversee education or health care or any of the other...
Precisely. So it's a violation of the... You and I, we can do whatever we want to do unless there's a law that says we can't. The government can only do what we have authorized it to do, and if it isn't in writing, they can't do it. If it isn't in writing, starting at the Constitution, they can't do it. And where in the Constitution have we authorized the federal government to get into education and to in any way control that the curriculum? Yes.
That's related to another interesting thing. I mean, all bills shall originate in the House.
All money bills. All money bills.
Does the president or anybody else have to do sending bills down there?
Well, he can send them down. They go to a committee, but...
But they didn't originate.
Well, he can send over bills, but any bill that gets passed has to... any money bill that has to get passed has to originate in the House. Yes.
Eminent domain and the ownership of public lands.
Yeah. Excellent case. So we have a fundamental right to property. The founders they knew we had all of these rights, liberties, and freedoms, and they meant to tie it to something concrete. And so the founders tied these rights to property, private property. And the case that stands out in my mind is the Kellogg case, where the city of Bridgeport... had a proposal from some pretty prominent national companies to build a research center and some other major facilities on some land in Bridgeport. And there were some folks there who did not want to sell their land. And that case went to court. And the Supreme Court ruled that it was okay for Bridgeport, the city of Bridgeport, to take a private party's land, not for a public purpose, but to give it to another private party because they could get more taxes from the other private party than they were getting from the current owner. A pretty gross violation of the Constitution. So we have the Constitution being violated not just by the two political branches, the Congress and the executive, but also by the court itself. So we have the federal government is violating the rule book. They are violating these prohibitions, restrictions, and mandates. One more that we'll mention at this time.
States' rights.
Immigration. We'll get to states' rights in a minute. Immigration. Is that a political question or is that a constitutional question? People act like it's a political question. Each side tries to outshout the other. That's what you do when when the issue is a political question. It's for the give and take of society. And so... on this immigration issue, illegal immigration issue, you had large numbers of people marching, taking to the streets, both for and against amnesty. You had hundreds of thousands of people signing petitions for and against amnesty. But is it a political question? They were sure acting like it was. We couldn't help. We, as an organization, we just don't get involved in political questions at all. They are for the give and take of society. We only get interested if government is doing something that they're not authorized to do or failing to do something that they are required to do. So we're only interested in constitutional questions. So we looked at the Constitution to see if this immigration issue was a constitutional question, and guess what we found? In Article 2, which is the article that lays out the powers of the president, it says not only shall he take an oath to defend the Constitution, but it also says he shall, quote, faithfully execute the laws. Well, there have been laws on the books for decades dealing with illegal immigrants, and they're not being enforced. They haven't been enforced for decades. I don't know why. Maybe neither party wants to offend the Latino vote, so they let it slide. Or there's a lot of other things. I mean, there's certain things that I cannot understand until I put it in the context of this new world order, and maybe that's why. I don't know, but it's a violation of the Constitution for the president as the chief law enforcement officer not to enforce these laws. Okay, so we have these violations of the Constitution. The question is, what can we, a free people, do about it? What can we do to bring the government back under the control, or do we care? Do we care if we've hit transition? I mean, the people running this country are clearly behaving and acting as though this is a democracy, and we're on that slippery slope of democracy, socialism, or something else, or something worse. So if we care, and if we, I mean, I do, if we're a free people, what can a free people do about this? To get the government back under the control of the Constitution. Anybody? Is there an accountability clause in the Constitution? Were the founders, what's that?
Stop paying taxes.
Stop paying taxes. How close you are. With the founders, the question is, maybe let me rephrase it. Would the founders have, and it's divine providence, right? So would they have given us this wonderful system of governance with all of these rights that are mentioned in here and all of these powers and all of these mandates placed on government? Property, privacy, trial by jury, no cruel and unusual punishment, the right to a government that does not impose a direct unapportioned tax on our labor, a right to an individual right, all of these are individual rights, a right to a government that does not apply the armed forces of the United States and hostilities overseas without a declaration of war, a government that does not infringe on our privacy, our right to privacy and so forth. Would they have given us that this system of governance without putting something right in the document itself to enable us legally and constitutionally to hold the government accountable? Is there an accountability clause?
Yes.
Yes,
yes, we have the right to petition.
The right to petition for... Yes, ma'am.
Oh.
Wait, which you already addressed.
But I was going to say, I think there's something in there that says that if the government's not doing it, then it's up to the people or the state. If the state's not doing it, or the people?
The people have the ultimate power rests with the people, yes. And we're the final arbiters of the Constitution, yes. So you mentioned the right to petition for redress of grievances. It's in the First Amendment. What five freedoms are guaranteed by the First Amendment in the order that they are mentioned, please?
Establishment of religion.
Religion is the first. Second? Right to free speech. Third? Press, right? Assemble, good. Well, as we're doing here today, we can still get together like this and criticize the government if we want to. It's the right to assemble. The fifth, freedom. Yes?
I would say the first freedom is the freedom from public religion, and the second freedom is the freedom of private religion.
Yes, it's all, yes. But the point is, we have a right or a freedom that's guaranteed by the First Amendment to worship as we choose. Right? That's guaranteed by the... It's a fundamental right. These are all... By the way, the beauty of our system is a recognition that all of these rights are unalienable, individual rights endowed by the Creator. You each have them simply because you are alive. No other reason. You're alive. You've got these rights. All right. So we've got... The First Amendment, five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. Worship, freedom to worship freely, speech, press, assembly, and the right to petition for redress of grievances. Five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. The first four of those have been the subject matter of lots and lots of lawsuits that have gone to the Supreme Court. So the full contours of the meaning of those first four freedoms is pretty well laid out. We know what our rights are, and we know what the government's obligations are. The fifth of those five freedoms, guaranteed by the First Amendment, the right to petition for redress. Redress means remedy, so you could substitute the word remedy for redress. The right to remedy grievances, the right to petition the government to remedy these grievances, especially these violations of the Constitution. The meaning of that freedom has never, ever been declared by any court in our entire history, and it is the Accountability Clause. It was put there by the framers, by the founders, as a critical part of the overall balance of power between the people and the government. It means this. If we have some evidence, and this is what we'll be talking about tonight, if we have some evidence that government has violated the Constitution. Remember, we've established this government. This is a servant government set up to secure our rights, no more, no less. So we have some evidence that the government is violating the rules that we've established for them, then we could call them on it. We could petition for redress of grievances. They are obligated to respond. You can't make them, but they're obligated to respond. And if they don't, what have we got? We've got a government that's turned its back on the Constitution. We, the masters, confront them, and they ignore us. Or worse, they retaliate. And that's not a government that we've established. That is not a government that I recognize any longer. So we have rights. If the government refuses to remedy the situation, refuses to respond to these petitions, we call them on their violations of the Constitution, and they refuse to respond, then we have the right to withdraw our support and resources from that government. That is a guarantee, that is a fundamental right. Now, try it individually. Try it as an individual or a small group and see what happens. You get your legs cut out from under you. You get retaliated against. You get beat up. Individuals and small groups, unfortunately today, it used to be that you could hold a government accountable through the petition clause. It worked every time until 1830. And we'll explain what happened in 1830. So we have this right, but we can't exercise, we can't prevail as individuals and small groups. Now there's this guy, Gandhi, that got India out from under British rule. He said it best. He said, when the people are up against unjust and uncivil government and laws, and they are entitled to change or reform, as we are, he said they will get it only if they follow a three-part formula. First, he said, they have to be proactive. You've got to be in their face. You've got to be, you know, having tea parties and all of these other things. You've got to be confronting them. So you've got to be proactive, nonviolent, and you need a mass movement, he said. So he said you'll get relief only if, he says, if you're missing any one of these three parts, you're going to fail. You have to be proactive, nonviolent, and you need a critical mass, a mass movement. In 1953, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote an extensive article about Gandhi and that formula. And he said back then, I'm going to follow that formula. And he was proactive, he was nonviolent, and he had eventually a mass movement. And he was successful in gaining, you know, the relief that he was entitled to. So, we're going to talk about the Continental Congress. And how we as a free people can bring the government back under the control of the Constitution, not individually and even as small groups, but with a mass movement, a critical mass. What's critical? I don't know. 5% ought to do it. That's 15 million people. You get 15 or 20 million or more people acting together, agreeing that this course of action is justified, this proactive, nonviolent course of action aimed at restoring the Constitution, claiming and exercising their legal and constitutional right, then that's going to make a difference. So we've got a little ahead of ourselves. Let me spend a couple of minutes and describe first a little bit of biographical information and how it is I come to be standing before you when doing this kind of work. I have an engineering degree from an education point of view. I have an engineering degree from one of the five federal academies, the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point on Long Island. I have a master's in business and administration of finance from Xavier, finished just about all the coursework required for a PhD in public administration from the Graduate School of Public Affairs at the State University of New York at Albany. I started my career as an engineer with the General Electric Company in the gas turbine department in Schenectady and moved over after a few years to the Corporate Research and Development Center. That's a group of some 600 scientists and engineers in Niskayuna, New York, which is right outside Schenectady. And based on some work I was doing there, which garnered a very significant amount of national attention, the Republican governor of Connecticut, a guy named Meskel, asked if I would go over to Connecticut and start up and administer a new state agency and get some laws on the books in this field that I was specializing in. So I did that for 3 years. Came back to New York, and the Democrat governor of New York, Hugh Carey, asked if I would set up and administer a policy office and get some laws on the books in New York in this field, which I did. I was then a full-time advisor to the administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, principally to get some business principles embedded or incorporated in this massive public works project run by EPA that funds much of the country's sewer and water works. And I was a investment banker for 4 or 5 years with Prudential-based securities on the public finance side. I was a talk show host. I set up a consulting company, a management consulting company, but I was also a talk show host on a principal Albany, New York radio station, WROW, from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday. When people get out of work and get on the phone, they have this attitude when they get out of work and they get on the phone. And everything was going well. One wife, 4 children, 9 grandchildren, and we started piecing together, reassembling parts of a farm that had been sold off, and we reassembled it, and then we built our home there in the late 60s. Everything was fine in my life, going swimmingly, taking care of my family and career, until 1979, when I was 40 years old. Until then, I had been led to believe that the government is always benevolent and always has the public interest uppermost in its minds, and you can really trust these guys. But something happened in where I live, the town and the county, I found out, were manufacturing a crisis and had concocted a solution that was going to benefit a few of them and their friends, but at everybody else's expense. And so I went to a meeting, wasn't paying much attention to things local where I live. Most of my time and work was being spent in my office in Albany and traveling around the country and so forth. But I went to a local meeting, and there was a county official describing this project. And they had already brought the people in the county to the polls to vote on this, and based entirely on what the government was telling the people approved this massive project 4-1. And of course, the town and county board had passed all the resolutions required to approve and finance this project. But I went to a meeting in a little firehouse around the bend from where I live, and at the end of his talk, this county official, I raised my hand. Had I not gone to that meeting and raised my hand, I would not be here today. I had a question. And he said, no questions. If you have a question, see me later. I just instinctively felt there's something wrong with that. I wanted my question heard and the answer heard by everybody in the room. And so I said to Judy, we're leaving. I want to get home, get on the phone, and start talking to a few people. And it was a covered dish luncheon meeting, and she said, not without my covered dish. And this is my wife, Judy, in the back. Anyway, I got home, and I talked to a few people, and that began a little investigation, and I discovered that this was a manufactured crisis. And I wanted, now I had 30 questions, so I went to the town board meeting, and I just thought that these were your representatives. I mean, if they're elected, they're going to answer these questions. And I started asking the questions, and it was pretty clear they were not happy I was there, and they were not about to answer any questions. And gosh, what does the free people do now, you know? And so I decided to do something I'd never done before, got a lawyer, and sued the town and the county. And he did the legal work, and I did the technical work. And 3 years later, the highest court in the state, the New York State Court of Appeals, issued a very robust decision in which they undid the results of the countywide referendum and nullified all the resolutions passed by the town and county board, because I had argued that they went ahead with this and they were violating the law. And I proved it and prevailed. But that changed my view. I would not be here today. I figured this is not a government that I had been led to believe existed. And I didn't think they had a corner on any of this corruption. And if I had been duped, a lot of other people had been duped. And so I better start paying closer attention, because the government could hurt people. And start paying more attention to what government was saying and doing. And it was also, I took it as a responsibility to start encouraging other people to do the same thing. A few years later, I learned another hard lesson about government, another side of government that I didn't know existed. I decided to do this work full time. And to pay for it, when I needed money to pay my taxes, or town taxes, property taxes, I would just sell another 2 acres of my land. And in order to do that, I had to get a subdivision, an 8-lot subdivision. And so it took me 2 years and quite a bit of money to get, because we're in what's called the Adirondack Park area of upstate New York, and it's very hard to get any development done up there. But anyway, I prevailed. And this was an 8-lot subdivision with a little road to come off of a town road. And I got all the permits, including the permit from the local town. And then the day that the trucks arrived with some road building material, a government vehicle drove up with big CO, drove up my driveway, and parked and got out and dropped a piece of paper on the porch. And it was a stop work order. The kids brought it in. It was a stop work order and issued by the town of Queensbury. And I looked at this and I wondered, could this possibly be retaliation? This is the lead defendant in the case I had, this big case, celebrated case, this case I had won at the Court of Appeals a few years earlier, was the test case of the New York State's State Environmental Quality Review Act. But in any case, was this retaliation? So I went to see the town supervisor, and just his body language convinced me that that's what it was. And so back to the law books, and they were saying I didn't have a right to tie into this town road, and I said, well, geez, you gave me a permit, and they said, well, gee, we thought it was a driveway, not a road, to service 8 lots, and they said, well, how could you come to that conclusion when the application included the full set of drawings for the whole subdivision and the road? Well, sorry, you know. And so I went back to the law library and to study what my rights were under the town, under the New York State highway law. And as engineers do, I studied the highway law from King George on down and learned what my rights were, and that they were wrong, I was right, and I had to take them to court. And I prevailed, they appealed, I prevailed. Now I'm absolutely convinced that something's terribly wrong in America. This is not the government that I was led to believe and that most people was led to believe existed. And that it was crucial now to start encouraging other people to be better informed about what their rights are, better informed about what's really going on in government, and most importantly, how to intelligently, rationally, nonviolently, professionally confront government when they step outside the boundaries that we, the people, have drawn around their power. And so we set up a little Tri-County Taxpayers Association back then, TCTA. You read about all of this in this. This is our corporate brochure. And when you get home, you'll see this is who we are and what we do, a little bit about our how we got here. But we set up this little Tri-County group to start scrutinizing the behavior of the governments in the three counties where I lived, Warren, Washington, and Saratoga County, and hauling them into court and winning cases because they were violating the state constitution and its laws. And then in 1990, we collapsed that group and we formed the All County Taxpayers Association, ACTA, A-C-T-A, started focusing at the federal, state level, and prevailing in many cases, twice, for instance, prevailed and got the court to agree that the governor of the state of New York, a very popular governor, had, in two cases, he didn't learn his lesson the first time, we had to do it again. He was using public funds to sway the results of elections, a pretty serious matter. And it was the beginning of the end, because our victories were editorialized all in every newspaper in the state. And it was the beginning of the end of a very popular governor, Governor Cuomo. And so we encouraged other people. We formed this statewide group. Many cases were brought to hold the government accountable to the state constitution and its laws. And in 1997, we set up the We the People organization and started setting our sights at the federal government and defending the Constitution of the United States of America, the federal Constitution. So we've set up now this We the People organization. I'm the founder and chairman of that. It's a national organization. It has two separate entities, two separate corporations. What we did was we went down to Washington and we investigated how the Center for Individual Rights, the Institute for Justice, all of these organizations were established. How did they create? How did they set themselves up? And what we learned was they had two components. One, a research and educational arm, and the other, a civic action arm. So our organization, the We the People organization, has two separate entities. The We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education, which is the civic education arm of what we do. And then there's the We the People Congress, which is the civic action arm of what we do. We firmly believe that civic education without action is for naught, just as civic action without education is for naught. You need to do both, and this is what we've been doing. And most of the work up until now has been under the auspices of the foundation. The foundation is a 501c3. We're interested in helping people to become better informed about what their rights are, better informed about what's really going on in government, and better informed about how to hold government accountable when they step outside the boundaries we, the people, have drawn around its power by the terms of our Constitution, both state and federal. We do not get involved in political questions at all. We avoid it like the plague. We don't support legislation or candidates or anything of the sort. We simply look at what government is saying and doing and comparing it with the requirements of our constitutions. If we see an impropriety or a conflict, we confront them by claiming and exercising our rights under the last 10 words of the First Amendment, the right to petition government for redress of grievances. Petitions for redress of grievances are not the same as the garden variety type of petitions that you hear about frequently. The garden variety type of the petition is, you know, somebody says, let's get 50,000 names on this signature, let's send it off to Washington, maybe it'll influence somebody's behavior, and maybe we'll get an answer, but they don't really expect one. You know, they're engaged in this political give and take on the issue. So petitions for redress of grievances are different. The government is obligated to respond, and if they don't, then you have certain rights, which we'll be talking about. So we have been claiming and exercising for many years the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. The civic action arm, until now, we knew this day would come, and we've been, you know, laying the groundwork to organize the people for what they're going to have to do eventually. But most of the work till now has been done under the auspices of the foundation, petitioning for redress. From here on in, it's the Congress that is going, the We the People Congress, that is going to be carrying most of the burden or weight of our work. We firmly believe in institutionalizing citizen vigilance. The vision that we have for the We the People Congress is institutionalized vigilance, making vigilance as much a part of our lives as something else we do regularly, like go to church or whatever. Institutionalizing vigilance, county by county, state by state, with carrying out two fundamental tasks. I mean, I'm devoting the rest of my life to institutionalizing vigilance in America. Two tasks to be carried out by the We the People Congress. Organize town by town, county by county, state by state. Two tasks. One, to distribute information about the history, the meaning, the effect, and the significance of every provision of our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Information that people are not getting from any other source these days. The other task, to institutionalize this process of scrutinizing governmental behavior at every level and comparing that behavior with the requirements of our constitutions and its laws, and wherever we see an impropriety, confronting government, doing whatever is necessary to get them back in the box. Remember, Jefferson said, when government takes one step outside the boundaries that we have drawn around its power, it takes possession of a boundless field of power. And so that's the, and as part of this vision for the We the People Congress is this. You know, as you go through your state capitals, you'll see a building with a dome on the top. I found out the other day, we were up in Alaska, it's the only state in the entire country that state capital doesn't have a dome on the top. But you, everywhere else, you go through your state capital and you see this building. The architecture varies from state to state, but every building has this dome on the top. And people have come to instinctively know when they see that building that that's where the government is doing it for or to the people. Right? We need another building in every state. And my choice for architecture is Jefferson's home down in Monticello. But we need another building in every state. Before I die, we're going to see them. So that distinctive architecture, so that when the people see those buildings, they will instinctively know that's where the people are watching the government. You've got lawyers and paralegals and support personnel, and they're supporting the work that's going on statewide, county by county, town by county. Town by town. If we can institutionalize environmental vigilance and wildlife vigilance, then why can't we institutionalize citizen vigilance of government? Being as passionate about freedom as people are passionate about the environment. So we have the Sierra Club. We have the Wildlife Federation. People are passionate. Gosh, there's a lot of people belong to those organizations. They're constantly writing checks. They die. They leave part of their estate to these organizations. What about freedom? It's as important as any of these other causes. And we need to institutionalize this vigilance. Some of our recent initiatives. Our current project of extreme importance and what we'll be talking about tonight is this Continental Congress 2009. There was a Continental Congress,
convened in 1774 and reconvened in 1775 and reconvened in 1776. What was going on back then? Great Britain had been ruling the 13 colonies, get this, for 150 years. That government had been in place in the colonies. And everything between the relationship between the people in the colonies and Great Britain was fine until 1763. It started to sour. Why? Because the French and Indian War ended, France was gone, Great Britain was left with this huge standing army in the colonies, and they had these outposts along the frontier because of the Indian situation. They had other standing armies around the world, of course. They ruled the seas. They were the most powerful government on the face of the earth, hands down. But they started to treat the people in the colonies differently from the way they were treating their people in Great Britain. They started violating their rights. Rights that people in Great Britain were enjoying. And so they started to petition for redress of those grievances. And for 11 years, they petitioned their government for redress of their grievances. Grievances involving a violation of their rights over and over again. Things like this, though, were happening. Their repeated petitions were being answered only with repeated injury for 11 years. There were people like Jefferson. He would argue in the colonial courts, and he would lose, and he would appeal, and Parliament would pass a law saying any appeals have to be heard in Great Britain over in England. So he had to get on a boat to go over there to handle his appeals. And he did that. That upset them. They passed another law that said there'll be no appeals. Things of that sort. This is how they were responding to the people's petitions for redress of grievances. And so what did they do? What did the founders do in 1774 after 11 years of petitioning for redress of these grievances? They decided to get together in Philadelphia, a few of their number from each of the 13 colonies, to talk about the situation. Not to separate from Great Britain, not to declare their independence. That's not why they went there. They went there merely to talk about their grievances and what they might be able to do about the situation. Sam Adams may have had separation in mind. I mean, things were really hot up in Massachusetts, and he was pretty determined. But most of them, that was not why they went there. And they got together in 1774, and of course things heated up while they were there. Shots were fired, Lexington conquered, and off they went. But that's not why they went there. So here we are, we find ourselves in exactly the same situation. We have a government that is violating our rights. We've been petitioning for a redress of grievances in the most humble terms, respectfully, professionally, intelligently, rationally, based on facts, no opinions, based on facts, only facts, and the government has refused to respond, or worse, retaliated, as we'll see. And so we're saying we've reached a point, we have to take a page out of the founders' playbook. We need to get a few of our number from each of the 50 states, people with a proven passion for the Constitution, as authors, as scholars, as activists, people of good character, people respected by in their communities. We need to send them. The people need to choose them. Select them from among themselves in each state and send them off to a continental congress. Not to separate, nothing like that, but to talk about these grievances and to settle on some course of action. This doctrine of non-resistance is absurd. But to settle on some course of action, some non-violent course of action to bring the government back under the control of the Constitution and therefore the people. So that was the history of the First Continental Congress. They got together simply to talk about their grievances. And of course they reconvened in 75 and 76, and eventually they had no choice, they felt, but to sign their Declaration of Independence. And they tried the Articles of Confederation. That didn't work. And then they adopted the Constitution. The greatest governing documents ever delivered to mankind. Hands down. The lamp of liberty was lit in America only. It has never been lit anywhere else but here. The cause of America is the cause of the world still. If that lamp of liberty is allowed to go out here, we enter these dark ages again. There's a lot at stake. So many of these states said, yes, we'll go along with the Constitution if there's a guaranteed rights, if there's a Bill of Rights. And so they added the Bill of Rights in 1791. So we're saying we need to repeat history. We need to select three people with a proven passion for the Constitution from each state and send them off to this Continental Congress. Picture the Continental Congress. Picture a large room, 50 tables, one state, one vote, but three delegates. Picture another 50 tables out of a respect for the role that the states have been given in our system of governance. Every member of every state legislature will receive a personal note inviting the legislatures of each state to send up to three of their number to the Continental Congress. Not to participate, but to observe. And then picture there's room or in that room, there's adequate space for members of the public, other government, and the media to observe. Not to participate, but to observe. Now, what are they observing? Here you have these delegates. Every day, deliberating, discussing, debating, and deciding. Every day, every word that's uttered in that room is recorded. Stenographic services preparing a written transcript of everything that's said in that room. And a live webcast. Every day, a live webcast of everything going on in that room. So the people of this country and the world to hear these discussions about this lamp of liberty, the way it's designed to work, going through the history, meaning, effect, and significance of these clauses, of these provisions, discussing with facts only, no opinions, how these clauses, how these provisions have been violated repeatedly, with facts. And then with facts, explaining how, discussing how the people of this country have petitioned this government, these governments, these last few, for a redress of these grievances, for a remedy of these grievances, with facts, documenting it. And then with facts, how the government has refused to respond or, in some cases, retaliate. Laying that picture out. Connecting the dots in the minds of people around the world, but also in the minds of people in this country. We need to connect the dots. Here's what's been happening for decades. Everything, it seems, has been couched in political terms. This is what we're bombarded with every day. Hardly any mention of the Constitution. If you don't like what's going on, vote for somebody else. It's him versus him or him versus her and so forth. And so people, for decades now, something the government does, people instinctively know. They may not know the clause or the language, but they instinctively know that's wrong. And they get fired up. And the internet burns up with messages. People outraged over this. It doesn't change the government's behavior, and then things quiet down for a period until the government does something else that's outrageous and that's unconstitutional. And maybe one or two people like Ron Paul or somebody mentions it's unconstitutional. But there's a lot of people who know the truth, and they get angry, and they fire up, they get emotional, and they fire up their computers and the internet again. And it doesn't change a thing. And then there's a period of quiet until the next violation, and then the next. And after a while, those people forget about the other ones, and they're only dealing with the one right before them. There's a pattern there. There's a pattern of constitutional violations, and a pattern of people attempting to hold them accountable, and a pattern of the governments answering these petitions only with repeated injury. That needs to be laid out in the minds of people around the world. And so that'll be going on at this Continental Congress. How do we get this critical mass? How do we get enough people educated, the dots connected, and enough minds around the country so that when those delegates recommend a course of action, nonviolent course of action, there is this critical mass of people, 15, 20 or more million people, who say, yes, you know, we understand this course of action is justified. It's time to push back in defense of our rights and to hang on to this greatest documents, governing documents ever given to mankind. How do we do that? Well, 50 state websites. Washington State has a state website. These websites now are the official source of all the information about the Continental Congress. What it is, what it is not. It is not a constitutional convention. It is a Continental Congress. It's not one bit concerned about amending the Constitution, only with defending the one we now have. And so all of the news about the Continental Congress, why it was convened, what are the issues, and the news that's coming out of there every day from their delegates and others, and on these state websites, the chat rooms and discussion groups and so forth, so people can, you know, talk about this and the like. The whole idea is to reach out to, by the time this process ends, when this is all over, mark my words, when this is over, by the end of this year, we are going to know just how many people in this country really care about hanging on to this Constitution and our fundamental system of governance. We're going to find out the character of the people of our country, whether they really care, whether it's okay, let it slide away, let this great American experiment end, and democracy or socialism or whatever the heck, it's okay. It's all right. We're going to find out before this year is over just how many people care. Now, we, as this foundation, can only go so far. We can lay out the vision. We can promote it. We can investigate the venues as to where this Continental Congress, inspect them, where these can be held, get proposals, and pay for it. We can choose the company that's going to do the live webcasting and pay for it. We can get the stenographers and pay for it. We can pay to go around the country and explain this whole process. We can facilitate. We can help you reach out to other people by putting things in your hand that you can use. We can help you with your delegate selection process and the voting for those. But the success of this Continental Congress is going to depend upon you, the people of each state. This is the third meeting, for instance, that I've held in the state of Washington, and tomorrow night I'll be in Spokane. There's now a core of people that have heard this presentation and that have stood up, as I'll ask you to do in a minute, and have said, yes, I'm willing to be called upon to assist in the work. I'm willing to be called upon from time to time to assist with the work that needs to be done in reaching out to people across this state so that they know about the Continental Congress, understand it, follow its progress, get their questions answered, and then come to conclude at some point, hopefully, prayerfully, that they're willing to stand with others and put a collective foot down against the tyrants of our day, and that this course of action is just absolutely justified. It's only going to work if there's a mass movement or a critical mass. So at this point, take a little break here and let's just ask you why you came to this meeting. Why are you here today? Why did you come here? Anybody? Yes?
For me, I need to answer how to handle things. I think my family's pretty similar. We used to have a lot of faith in...
That's your mother and father next year.
Yes, okay. My mother and my father.
All right.
A big turning point for us is the bailout, the initial bailout. So many millions of people. I mean, there have always been things before that where we realized it's messed up, unconstitutional, and wrong. But we thought, you know, maybe the government will still listen to people, especially when there's an overwhelming majority. And when the bailout, when they first initially announced it, I called my representatives and millions of others. They've never been so busy for their entire lives. I mean, not only was it unconstitutional, but amazingly, the people were aware and were against it. And still, we were ignored.
Well, why did you come to this meeting today?
So I want to find another way to address the issue. How to...
Because
this way, they're calling millions of people, basically kind of what you said before, where almost like people sign a letter, sign a piece of paper.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be working. So I'm just trying to find
maybe
this way, kind of Congress.
Got it. Anyone else? Why did you come here today? Why are you here? Yes, sir.
Well, I hope to, since I have related signatures, the Supreme Court would have a question and then we would solve it. I'm looking desperately for a nonviolent approach that may work.
Okay.
Or the one I've tried has gotten.
Sending letters doesn't get anywhere. More petitions. Or garden variety type petitions. Yes. Yes, sir.
I came to ask a couple of questions about the convention and talk about some possible constitutional solutions.
Great. Anyone else? Yes, sir, in the back.
I came here because I've been actively involved with several individuals being very aggressive in their study and pursuing their ability to pursue judicial remedy, and now there's entertaining the concept about so-called emergency. And why I came here is because none of these efforts, although they're occasionally successful, really prove that they have real teeth in the law. And I came here to monitor, or in other words, assess, where are we in this process, and are we ready to come together around something? And that's why I came.
Can we agree that the judiciary is highly politicized and quite corrupt?
Yep.
I mean, after 30 years, I mean, if you put my name at LexisNexis, you'll get at least 155 reported decisions in cases I have brought over the years against local, state, and federal officials. So I've learned a little bit. I've done the research. I've written the briefs. I've argued the cases in the highest state and federal courts. And one of my observations, and I'm a long time, observer of all these dynamics, one of my observations is clearly the judiciary is highly politicized and quite corrupt. Anyone else? Why are you here?
Because the sense here in the last 10, 15 years that the departure from our Constitution has been absolutely inescapable.
Good. Anyone else?
I've been, talking to people about the violations of the Constitution that I've witnessed my whole life since high school, really. I started doing this and talking to people and it doesn't seem to have much effect, and this is an opportunity for people to join together to actually do something. So thank you.
Okay. All right. So, for sure, all the evidence, and again, we don't deal with opinions, we only deal with facts. All the evidence, the facts support this this claim that the government is violating numerous provisions of the Constitution. I was asked at a meeting like this the other night, is there any provision of the Constitution that they're not violating? And I was kind of hard-pressed. Well, there is this provision about the post office. I'm not sure that they're violating that. But in any event, hard-pressed to find one that they're not violating. So they are violating it, and numerous attempts have been... over the years, have been made to hold them accountable. They refuse, the record shows, the facts show, that they refuse to be held accountable. They refuse to justify their behavior. Absolutely will not be held, will not answer these questions, or worse, they will retaliate. And so we have a government that is violating the Constitution and refuses to be held accountable. So, what is our duty, individual duty and responsibility as a free people? Do we do what a lot of people do? They say, well, you know, our job is just to focus on my family and my career and let George worry about this, whoever George is. Or do we have, as American citizens, given this wonderful system of governance, recognizes that we have these rights and they don't come from the state, we can't take them away. We have a rule book, a set of principles that's meant to govern the government. We're not mentioned except the fact that we adopt it. What's our duty? What's our responsibility when it's under such attack, or whenever it's attacked? It's the duty of every citizen of the United States of America to abide by, protect, and preserve our Constitution, to respect the ideals of our founding fathers, and to create institutions that provide law and order to our society in preservation of the Constitutional Republic. So the preservation, the protection, the enhancement of individual liberties, rights, and freedoms ought to be high on our priority list as individuals who are blessed to be living in this country. So, at this point, I'm going to ask if you are willing to be called upon from time to time to assist in the work that's going to be required between now and the time of the Continental Congress and during the time it's convened, work involved in outreaching, reaching out to other people in all the ways that we have to do that, and in selecting the delegates, getting good delegates nominated and selected from this state, if you are willing to be called upon from time to time to assist with this work, to assist your state and regional district coordinators, if you're willing to be called upon from time to time, stand up. That's great. It's very heartwarming. Thank you. This is the kind of, please, this is the kind of response we've been getting all across the country. Some 86 meetings like this over all 50 states. We'll finish up on May 1st, and we're getting that same kind of response. Please, at this point, the second sheet down behind the paperclip, it's entitled Citizen Action Form. Please, take a few minutes and answer those questions. If you need a pen, let me know. We have pens up here. Take a few minutes. This is also a good time. We'll take a 10-minute break. All right, so those of you who stood up, thanks. And some of you have decided to hold off on volunteering until you hear some more tonight. Okay. We said earlier that these last 10 words of the First Amendment, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, is an accountability clause. Of course, there's another one. It's in the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
but there are two. And the way it's designed to work, if the first one doesn't work, the second one, you might have to resort to that. So if no court has ever declared what the meaning of this accountability clause, these last 10 words of the First Amendment is, then how do we know what was in the minds of the guys that put it there? The framers who added these words to the First Amendment. What were they thinking about? What was their intent? What did they know about? Why did they put those words there? What clues do we have as to the meaning of the right to petition for redress of grievances? What are our rights and what are the obligations of the government? Where do we go to find out?
Federalist Notes.
It all began with the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is the cradle of liberty. All Western civilization and all liberty evolved from the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was signed in the year 1215. At that time, the king, the monarchy, had absolute power. They could do no wrong. They were viewed as God's representatives on earth. You couldn't sue them. Absolute power. And then the King John was confronted by some of the barons and the people in the community at a place called Runnymede, a field in Runnymede. And the people had pitchforks. So there was a little bit of a threat there. But the king signed the Magna Carta. This is section 61 from the Magna Carta. It lays out the rights of the people for the first time. Lays out the rights of the people and the obligations of the government. Rights of the people, if the government, if they feel the government is violating their rights, the obligation of the government to respond, and if they don't, what rights do the people have? This is what it says is this. If the people feel that the government, or monarchy, is transgressing, violating any of the rights of man, then the people can petition, can bring their grievance, the offense, to the attention of the government, the monarchy. They can declare it and claim immediate redress. How important is it that the government respond? What is their obligation to respond? It says, if we don't respond in 40 days, then the people have the legal right to take everything we own, our castles, lands, possessions, everything else except our lives. And then, having secured their redress that you've determined upon, you may, not shall, you may then resume your normal obedience to us. Here it is. Let's read it. If we, our chief justice, if we, the monarchy, our chief justice, our officials, or any of our servants, offend in any respect against any man, or transgress any of the articles of the peace or of this security, and the offense or the grievance, and the offense is made known to four of the said 25 barons, they shall come to us, or in our absence from the kingdom, to the chief justice, to declare it and claim immediate redress. If we, or in our absence abroad, the chief justice, make no redress within 40 days, reckoning from the day in which the offense was declared to us, or to him, the chief justice, the four barons shall refer the matter to the rest of the 25 barons, who may distrain upon and assail us in every way possible, with the support of the whole community of the land, by seizing our castles, lands, possessions, or anything else, saving only our own person, our lives, and those of the queen and our children, until they have secured such redress as they have determined upon. Having secured the redress, they may then resume their normal obedience to us, end quote. First time, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances regarding the violations of man was ever declared in writing. This right to petition the government, to hold them accountable, then began to flourish in Great Britain. It grew and grew, and more people were claiming and exercising their right to hold their government accountable. A few hundred years later, for instance, there was a king named James who had leanings towards Rome, Catholicism. He issued a proclamation. He said, the people of Great Britain have the right to worship any way they want to worship, and I want this proclamation, he said, read from every pulpit in Great Britain on this particular day. There were seven bishops who had a problem with this. They reasoned, if we do this, if we read that proclamation from our pulpits, then we will be acknowledging that this right comes from the king, not from God. So we can't do this. This is a grievance. Let's go and talk to the king about this, and let's petition him for a redress of this grievance. So they set out to meet with the king. He heard they were coming. He was delighted until they got there, and they explained why they were there. They were going to read this thing. He immediately put them in the dungeon, in the prison. They got a lawyer. There's a jury trial. Their defense was, we were merely petitioning the king, the government, for a redress of the grievance. And the jury acquitted them on that defense. So this right grew and grew, and as those people migrated to our shores beginning in the 1600s, they knew about this right to petition the government to hold them accountable for a redress of their grievances. And they were claiming it and exercising it. Everything worked fine here until the end of the French and Indian War, as they said. The government started to treat the people differently, and they were treating their own people, violating their rights. And they petitioned for 11 years. And in 1774, they decided to get together in Philadelphia. I don't know why they chose Philadelphia, other than it was halfway between the northern and southern boundaries of the colonies. But they decided to get there to talk about this situation. That they had these grievances. The government was violating their rights, and they were petitioning. The government was blowing them off, or worse. So they decided to get together to talk about this. That's all. Not to separate. Not to declare their independence. So they got together in 1774, in September. And in October, remember, we're looking for clues. What's the historical context and purpose of those 10 words of the First Amendment? What was the framers' intent? What did they know about? What did they intend here? What was the meaning? Here's another clue. In 1774, in October, a month after they convened the Continental Congress, they passed an act unanimously. The title of the act is The Continental Congress to the Inhabitants of Quebec. It was an attempt to get the Canadians to sympathize with them against their common government. And in this 8-page act, which you can find in its entirety on our website or at the Journals of the Continental Congress, page 105, the framers say this in this act, the founders, the delegates to the Continental Congress. They say, in this act, we are going to talk about the grand rights of the people, the great rights, the individual rights. And in talking about what they call the first of the grand rights, the right to government based upon the consent of the people, they said this. If money is wanted by rulers who have in any manner oppressed the people, they may retain it until their grievances are redressed, remedied, and thus peaceably procure relief. It is a non-violent solution to the problem of arbitrary power and oppression, and thus peaceably procure relief without trusting to despised petitions. They knew the people had the right to petition for redress of grievances, but they also knew that governments don't like opposition from any quarters. They may not respond, or worse. So without trusting to despised petitions or disturbing the public tranquility, people can procure relief nonviolently by retaining their money if the government violates their rights and they petition and government refuses to respond. Powerful clue. Here's how Jefferson put it a year later in a letter to the Prime Minister of Great Britain. The privilege of giving or withholding our money is an important barrier against the undue exertion of prerogative by the government if left altogether without control may be exercised to our great oppression. And all history shows how efficacious this privilege of giving and retaining your money, how efficacious its intercession for redress of grievances and establishment of rights, and how improvident, how dangerous, how nonsensical, how just plain stupid would be the surrender by the people of so powerful a mediator, the privilege of giving and retaining your money. It is the only nonviolent way to hold the government accountable when you petition for redress of these grievances and they refuse to respond. The only nonviolent way. We get a very powerful clue as to what was meant in 1791 in those last 10 words of the First Amendment. We get a powerful clue from the Declaration of Independence itself. Just what, how important, how much emphasis did the founders put on our right to hold the government accountable? Our right to petition for a remedy to these grievances. What are our rights and what are the obligations of the government to respond? Did they think the government had an obligation to respond in 1776? Yes. Mm-hmm. My version of the Declaration of Independence in this pocket-sized version is 5 pages. The Declaration of Independence takes up 5 pages. 3 of those pages are devoted to the listing of the grievances that the founders had against the government of their day. One grievance after another, most of them beginning with the word he, the king. King George is doing this, this, and the other thing. And then at the end of that list of grievances, you have what the constitutional scholars call the capstone grievance. This is what they call it, the capstone grievance. The grievance that capped all the others. The grievance that more than any one of the others led to this decision to separate. This is it. The capstone grievance, the words right out of the Declaration of Independence following this list of grievances. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only with repeated injury. A prince or a government whose character is thus marked by every act which would define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people, and that capstone grievance made it through every draft of the Declaration of Independence with the exception of one word. The word free was added before people. Did they think it was important for the government to respond and redress these grievances? You bet. It led to the separation. It led to the Declaration of Independence. They petitioned for 11 years without success. After the Declaration of Independence was signed, states were adopting their constitutions. New York, ours was adopted in April of 1777. The founders in 1791, when they put that capstone right at the end of the right that caps all the others at the end of the First Amendment, they knew what was going on. It was common knowledge. What was showing up in the rights of the people and the obligations of the government in America was showing up in these state constitutions. This is an article out of the New Hampshire Constitution. It was in there originally and it's still there. Government being instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the whole community, and not for the private interest or emolument of any one man, family, or class of men, not even bankers. Therefore, whenever the ends of government are perverted and public liberty manifestly endangered, and all other means of redress are ineffectual, the people may, and of right, ought to reform the old, as with retaining your money, or establish a new government. The doctrine of non-resistance against arbitrary power and oppression is absurd, slavish, and destructive of the good and happiness of mankind. When government violates our Constitution routinely, as they have been doing, and we call them on it, and they refuse to respond, they're exercising arbitrary power, and that is oppression. And to stand by and do nothing, and to let this happen, and to let the constitutional republic slide out of existence and be replaced by some democracy or worse, to stand by and do nothing about that, not to resist, is absurd. So here you have, I think, the greatest sentence, the most important sentence in the entire Constitution. The First Amendment guarantees this right to think freely and speak freely and assemble freely and to hold the government accountable. To all of these other rights, all these other individual rights that are laid out in the Constitution, the individual right to a government that does not apply the armed forces of the United States in hostilities overseas without a declaration of war. I am not against war. I volunteered to help out in Vietnam. I'm only for the Constitution. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not against war. It's necessary sometimes. The individual right to a government that does not impose a direct unapportioned tax on your labor, a violation of the taxing clauses. A right not to developing a police state with all of this surveillance and where everybody is now, you know, guilty until proven innocent. Isn't that how you feel when you go through an airport? Everybody's guilty until proven innocent. It's just common now. So we have only these individual rights. Privacy, property, trial by jury, no cruel and unusual punishment, and on and on and on. But what good are these rights? Any right, if we don't have the ability to enforce them, it's well settled in American jurisprudence. I had the top judge in New York State say as much in a case that I had before her. Any right that is not enforceable is not a right. Any right that is not enforceable is not a right. So we have all of these rights, pages of them. What happens if government violates them, steps outside the boundaries that we have drawn around their power, doing things that we have not authorized them to do and not doing things that we have mandated that they do? How do you hold them accountable? How do you enforce those rights? Any right that is not enforceable is not a right. You lose them if you can't enforce them. You know, there's 10 law review articles have been published on this right to petition the government for redress of grievances. They were published in 1986 and 87. There weren't any before that. There weren't any after that I know of. What happened in 1986 to wake up the law schools to start, and these professors and lawyers, and start writing about the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, the last 10 words of the First Amendment? What happened? President Reagan nominated somebody to be a federal judge. And there was a citizen who didn't think the guy was qualified, so he wrote a letter to the president, said as much, sent a copy to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, and released it to the press. The guy didn't get the job. He was angry, sued the man for libel. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in its decision, did not declare the meaning of the right to petition government for redress of grievances, but they mentioned it because this was one of his defenses. He got a lawyer, and among his defenses, he merely said, "Hey, I was just petitioning for redress of grievances." And so the Supreme Court said this about the First Amendment right to petition. The Supreme Court said, in its written decision, "Just as the right of free speech is not absolute, it does not give anyone the right to yell fire in a dark, crowded theater, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances is not absolute. It doesn't give anybody the right to libel somebody." That's all they said. Well, the law school was, "Oh, what's this? What's this right to petition? There's no case law on it, no precedent." And they said, "What's this? Right to petition." And they were curious. Geez, the Supreme Court mentioned the right to petition. So they got curious and they looked into it. And there were 10 law review articles published. Two of them are thorough historical reviews of the meaning of the right to petition. One published by Akhil Amar, a professor at Yale. You can find all 10 of them on our website. Click on and read them all. There's two that I would encourage you to read. Lights will go on in your heads. One by Akhil Amar, published in the Yale Law Journal, and the other by a Professor Gregory Mark, a professor at Rutgers. He published his in the Fordham Law Review. You learn wonderful. You learn so much by reading these historical reviews. You learn, for instance, this. Until 1830, after the Constitution was adopted and after the Bill of Rights, and people were petitioning their government for redress of grievances, state legislatures, state legislators, county, federal government, elected officials were being petitioned for redress of grievances. People were participating in their government. You didn't have this level of apathy that you have today because they were participating. And back then, until 1830, if you petitioned your member of Congress, guess what? You always got an answer. Guess what? It always went to a committee. Guess what? Every Monday, Congress dealt with petitions for redress of grievances. And you always got an answer. Compare that with today. You always got an answer. But what happened in 1830 to change all this? In 1830, the Southern congressmen prevailed. And they got what the scholars in these law reviews called a gag rule passed. They called it the gag rule. What the Southern Congress, what the vote determined was that any of these petitions coming from abolitionists seeking to end the practice of slavery would be permanently tabled. First time government ever went on the record saying we don't have to listen or respond to the people. It took John Quincy Adams 8 years to get that rule repealed. But damage had been done, been downhill since. It's become all but forgotten, this right to petition the government for redress of grievances. But think had they not passed that gag rule. Think had they responded, had they knew about their obligation to respond, and had they responded. You may have had what has happened in every other country. You may have had a non-violent solution to the slavery problem years before. You know, Emancipation Proclamation. Years before. Had they responded. So you learn that, and you learn other wonderful things about the right to petition. You learn, for instance, that the right of free speech and freedom of the press and freedom to assemble derived from the pre-existing right, derived from the necessity to protect the pre-existing right to petition the government for redress of grievances. For instance, you learn that prior to the Magna Carta and so forth, you know, and the recognition as it grew, this right, if members of Parliament said anything nasty about the monarch would simply dissolve Parliament. That's had that right. Just dissolve Parliament. They didn't create another one when he got around to it. Or worse, take somebody's head. But after this, people were petitioning members of Parliament for a redress of their grievances. Well, what good is the right to petition for redress of grievances if Parliament couldn't talk about these things and whatever they said about the monarch, the government? And the same thing with the press. No longer could you prosecute for seditious libel, people writing about the monarchy as they were writing about it based on these petitions. And now people could get together to talk about their grievances and draw up their petitions for redress of grievances. So the scholars make it very clear that the right of free speech and press and assembly derived from the pre-existing right to petition the government for redress of grievances. So I would encourage you to read one or both of those historical reviews. You'll find them on our website, the first one by Akhil Amar and the other one by Gregory Mark. We have been petitioning for redress of grievances. Lots of people have. Petitioning our federal government for a redress of grievances, violations of the Constitution. Many people have been doing this. We can only talk about what this organization, what we have been doing. In 1995, we brought an action against President Clinton and Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin for bailing out the Mexican peso to the tune of $20 billion. They had no authority to do that in the Constitution, so we took them to court. We knew that the court had a tendency to violate or to abuse the judicial doctrine of standing. I'm going to have to explain this now because it's going to come up a few more times tonight, this standing doctrine. It means this. If these two people feel that their right or some act of Congress, some violation of the Constitution, and so they go to court, they file their papers, they pay their fee, now the court has the case. The court presumably is on its way to determining the case on its merits. Are they right or are they wrong? So the court is going to issue a decision that's either going to be in their favor or against them. The standing doctrine is this. The court says, if our decision is going to have no impact on this person's life, then he has no standing. No matter how the court decides the case, up or down, if it's not going to impact his life, he has no standing because the courts, and we're not going to hear the case, because the courts are not in the business of just chatting with people. You have to have an alleged injury. It has to have some impact on you. So if the court's decision, up or down, is going to affect his life, on the other hand, then he has standing and the court will hear the case. The court has jurisdiction. So in this case, we knew that the courts have a tendency, the federal courts, all the courts, have a tendency to abuse its standing doctrine. The standing doctrine makes sense. It's a good doctrine, but it can be abused. You can dismiss cases saying the people don't have any standing, their injury is no different than anybody else's injury in the country, so, you know, what makes them so special? Case dismissed. Wrong. These are individual rights in this country. And if somebody goes to court and challenging on constitutional grounds some act of the government, you know, claiming that his individual right, in this case, to a government that does not abuse its powers, there's nothing in the Constitution that authorized the federal government to lend Mexico to bail out their peso to the tune of $20 billion. And so we knew that the government or the courts might abuse the standing doctrine. So we put the call out. And we said, we need plaintiffs in this case who own shares of stock in Federal Reserve banks. Because we want to make it hard for the judiciary to abuse its standing doctrine. They don't like to decide these constitutional challenges. They'd rather avoid them. And so let's make it hard for them. Anybody out there own any shares of stock in Federal Reserve banks? Obviously, if Mexico doesn't pay the money back, this Federal Reserve banks are going to take a hit, and so are you. We got 12 plaintiffs in the case who own shares of stock in Federal Reserve banks. They were the plaintiffs. Janet Reno was the Attorney General. Her first move was to ask the court to dismiss the case on the basis of sovereign immunity, saying the government is sovereign. The people don't have the right to sue the government. So with the help of Akhil Lamar and others, we wrote a powerful brief, and we forced her to withdraw that defense. But then the court went on and ignored the fact that we had these, never mentioned it. United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit of Manhattan never mentioned the fact that we had 12 plaintiffs who owned shares of stock in Federal Reserve banks. They just dismissed the case on the basis of lack of standing. And as we do with everything we do, we take it as far as we can take it. We exhaust our judicial remedies. We never put ourselves in the position where the other side, the government, is able to say, gee, if you had only appealed it, if you had only taken advantage of the next, you know, authority that you had, you might have gotten a reversal. No. So we took it to the Supreme Court, and they decided not to hear the case. So we exhausted our judicial remedies in that case. In 1999, I was a talk show host in Albany, and I was on the way down to the studio one afternoon, and the bombs are falling on Kosovo in the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. So I got on the air with my audience. I said, whose decision was this? Well, I was president. What does the Constitution say? Well, the Constitution says only Congress can make that kind of a decision. Did they? No. What are we going to do about it? What does the free people do? What is the appropriate next step? We have some evidence that government is violating the Constitution. Are we going to let it slide? Or is it our responsibility to do everything we can to keep them in the box? So we decided we would take the President, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Secretary of Defense to court in defense of the War Powers Clauses. There's no declaration of war by Congress. The President has usurped the power of Congress, and Congress has acquiesced again. And so we drew up the papers, and we went to go, and we knew that standing, you know, we've got to really work hard now because the judiciary, you know, they're pretty politicized, and they may not want to hear this case and probably will not want to hear this case. So let's make it very hard for them to dismiss this case on the basis of lack of standing. So I put out on the air, is there anybody out there that owns any land over there in Yugoslavia, in Kosovo, where these bombs are falling? Surely you have standing. And within a day, we got a call from a Greek Orthodox priest. Our signal in Albany was not strong enough to reach New York City, but word of mouth does. And within a day, we got a call from a Greek Orthodox priest from Lower Manhattan who said, I have in my congregation a young man who just finished Fordham Law School. He studied constitutional law. He says, you're absolutely right. What's going on is unconstitutional. And he and his sister own land in Montenegro and Belgrade. And he has a grandmother sitting in an apartment in Belgrade. And, you know, every now and then, one of these missiles goes astray, like the one that went astray in this bombing campaign, and it hit the Chinese embassy, you may recall, and killed some Chinese. It was a big international incident. And so certainly this guy has standing. Fine. He's a plaintiff. We put out on the air. A lot of these bombs and missiles are coming from aircraft that are coming off carriers. The government must be calling up reserve units of aircraft engine mechanics and pilots. Anybody out there that's in a reserve unit that's been called up or might be called up within 6 minutes? Somebody called and said, Bob, we've been listening to the show for months. You're absolutely right. When you say the Constitution does not defend itself, you can say it lies there. If we don't defend it, it doesn't get defended. So he said, I'll be a plaintiff. And so he was with the 109th Air National Guard attached to Schenectady Airport and in a unit that was called up. And so he decided to be a plaintiff. And then we had a couple of pilots who were flying commercial for U.S. Air who had recently retired as Air Force pilots. So we thought we had this thing knocked. I mean, how are they going to, you know, dismiss this thing for lack of standing with all of this? And sure enough, they dismissed the case for lack of standing. In 1999, I was getting ready for the show one day, and a message crossed my computer screen about this special agent of the Criminal Investigation Division of the Internal Revenue Service. His name was Joseph Bannister. And according to what I read, he had asked his superiors to answer some questions, and they refused to answer the questions, and they fired him. Questions about his authority to enforce the law the way he was trained to enforce it. So I had the producer track him down. I said, that's interesting. Here we got a guy petitioning his government for redress of a grievance, and they retaliated. So I had the producer track him down, spoke to him at home, learned his story, and had him on the air. His story was, he comes from a family, he's a devout Christian with a conscience. And it's the conscience that got him in trouble. He comes from a family of uniformed people. His father, his brothers, they're all state police, local police, firemen. He had a CPA. He practiced accounting for Pete Barwick and Mitchell for a few years. Decided he wanted to go to work for the FBI or the Treasury Department. The FBI had a hiring freeze on. The Treasury Department hired him. He excelled in every one of his training courses. Now he was a special agent of the Criminal Investigation Division. Got to wear a badge and a gun and a car. You know, and there he was enforcing the Internal Revenue Laws the way he was told to enforce them. And he was listening to the talk show host in the San Francisco Bay Area one day. The host was Jeff Metcalf. He was interviewing a woman named D.B. Kidd. And they were talking about the fact that the Internal Revenue Laws are fine the way they're written. They're constitutional. But they're unconstitutional in their application. They're enforced as though they are, you know, they're making it a... They're imposing a direct unapportioned tax on people's labor, which is unconstitutional. The word income doesn't mean what the common thing, what it's come to mean today. The word income means what it meant, what that word meant when those words were added in 1916. It means the 1913. It means corporate income and corporate profit and so forth. And so Joe Bannister, hearing this, said, my gosh, they're talking about me and my authority to do what I'm doing here. And the authority of the Internal Revenue Service to do what they're doing. And so he said, I'm going to look into this and I'm going to prove them wrong. This was his conscience at work. And so he started on a journey, 2 years, and of his own time and money, he investigated this. And along the way, he sort of got turned around. And he submitted, in February of 1999, he submitted a 95-page report to his superiors, simply asking them to help him understand. He didn't release this report. This was to his superiors. And within 1 week, they fired him. They forced him out. And so he told me this story. He said he put his 95-page report, he took out a website, he put it up there. I read it. These were legitimate questions, questions the government should answer. Why not? Well, they got to hide. And so we had him on the air. We had others on the air. We decided to help him get answers to his questions. So we said to the audience, how can we help them? They said, well, if we go to court, you know, we'll get dismissed for lack of standing. So we decided we'd write a letter to the heads of the political branches, the Congress and the executive branch. And we invited them to a conference at the National Press Club on this particular day. We said respectfully, please identify your best legal minds on this subject and meet with our people, Joe Bannister and Bill Benson and Larry Beecrate, the constitutional tax attorneys, and discuss these issues and answer some questions in a recorded public forum at the National Press Club on some day in July of 1999. They didn't show, but C-SPAN showed, broadcast the event 3.5 hours live. So there on national television is Joe Bannister telling his story, and the constitutional tax expert, Larry Decraft, telling his story, and Bill Benson telling their story. Someone from the audience said, what do we do now? The government doesn't appear interested in responding. And we said, well, we'll try it again in November. We'll just try it again. And so we reserved the ballroom at the National Press Club. We went through the drill again. We invited them. They didn't show. So now the question is, what does the free people do now? Do we just turn our backs on this? And, you know, what can you do? There's always been corruption in government. They'll always be around. You know, pay attention to your family and your career. That's our job. Or do we continue to try and get them to answer these questions and help this man get his questions answered? So what we decided to do there at the National Press Club, we decided that we would, if they won't come to us, the government, we'll go to them. That we'll prepare a petition, a written petition for redress of grievances. We'll put it on the website. We'll get people to sign it. And then we will bring it and serve it on the president at the White House. And we will serve this petition for redress of grievances on the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader. And we chose a day and date the following April. This was November when we did. And we chose a day in the following April. And we also said that it would be important if there was a delegation of people representing all 50 states in Washington to serve this on the President and the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader. And so we drew it up, we put it on the internet, 9,800 people signed it, and we also put on the internet, on our website, we were the names and the states that all of these people were coming. We were going to have a delegation of people representing all 50 states in Washington to serve this. And there it was, on the internet, on our website, all of the people in the states that they were representing. Every state was represented. And now it's getting close to this day in April, I forget the exact date, April 15th or 13th. And now the date's getting closer. We got to think, oh, gee, what have we got ourselves into here? How do you go about serving a petition for redress of grievances on the President of the United States at the White House and on the leaders of Congress? How do you do that? Who's going to receive us, this delegation? So we did some research. We couldn't find. There was nothing on this. So I got a little worried, frankly. So a week before the event, when everybody was supposed to be in town, I decided I'd better go find out. I went down to the White House. I had never been there before. So I approached one of the security checkpoints. The voice said, yes, can I help you? And I said, I'm Bob Schultz. I'm chairman of the We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education. Next Tuesday, there's going to be a delegation of people representing all 50 states meeting at the National Press Club. And at 1 o'clock, we'll be coming over here to serve a petition for redress of grievances regarding the legality of the income tax on the president. Who's going to receive us? What gate shall we arrive at? The guy came out of his shack and said, I've been here a long time. This has never happened. He said, use this phone. Call this number. It's in the White House. It's a department. I got on the phone. I went through the drill. I'm Bob Schultz. I'm chairman of the We the People Foundation for Constitutional Education. Next Tuesday, there's going to be a delegation of people representing all 50 states gathering at the National Press Club. And at 1 o'clock, we're coming over to serve a petition for redress, a First Amendment petition for redress of grievances on the president. Who's going to receive us? What gate do you want us to arrive at? The person at the other end says, I don't know. It's never happened. Let me transfer it to this department. I was there for 2 hours. I went through one, but at the end of 2 hours, everybody in the White House knew that next Tuesday there was going to be a delegation of all 50 states coming over to serve the petition for redress of grievances regarding the legality of the income tax. Finally, somebody said, you know, we don't know. This has never happened. And so, but we'll have an answer for you tomorrow. Call us tomorrow. So I went home, called them. I didn't get an answer. Didn't get an answer. Now, it's Tuesday. We're all there at the National Press Club. And at 1 o'clock, we're forming up. We're about to leave. Go over to the White House. The phone rings. It's the White House at the National Press Club. And they say, okay, because they're watching everything that's going on. And they say, okay, we'll see three of you. Only three. The rest will have to, you can come in the security, come in the gate, in the security, but you'll have to wait right outside. Can't have all of you in the White House at the same time. And so we chose Joe Bannister, myself, and for the third person, we decided it would be nice to get the whole thing on videotape. So we didn't know if they would let us in, the videographer with his camera. But we said, well, why, you know, go until you're stopped. And so we chose somebody, had the camera, and all of us went through the security checkpoint with the camera. And we were shown to the office of Jason Furman, the president's economic advisor. And on tape, he receives the petition for redress of grievances. He accepts it for the president. And on tape, we explain we're having trouble getting the two sides together. We're having trouble getting the government to respond to our First Amendment petition for redress of grievances. We said we're going to try again in a recorded public forum on June 29th. This was April. We're going to try again in June. Will the executive branch participate? Yes, we will. Great. We went out, we briefed the delegation, we walked up to the Capitol where we now had a similar last-minute meeting arranged with the Speaker, Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House. And on tape, he accepts the petition for redress of agreements regarding the legality of the income tax, the way it's being enforced. And on tape, he says the experts from the House Ways and Means Committee will participate in the upcoming June conference. Fantastic. We then go through the rotunda, and we meet briefly with Senator Lott and then with his chief policy director. And on tape, he accepts it for the Speaker, for the Senate Majority Leader. And on tape, he says, experts at the House Senate of the Senate Finance Committee will participate. Great. Now we're getting ready for the June 29th conference. A week or 10 days or so before that, I called the White House, spoke to Jason Furman again. And he said, we've had a change of mind. Where the quote, the legality of the income tax is not a high priority matter for the White House, and we will not be participating in any conference on the subject. I said, what do you mean it's not a high priority matter? Do you understand what's happening out here? People can read and comprehend. They're reading the law. They cannot find where it says they're required, you know, to file a tax return and to pay this tax. And they're petitioning their congressmen. They're petitioning their superiors. They're petitioning the IRS. They're getting no answer. So they're acting on their beliefs. Silence is admission at some point. So they're acting on their beliefs. And when they act on their beliefs, you're coming down hard on them. You're turning their lives upside down. Some of them are committing suicide. What do you mean it's not a high priority matter for the White House? You've got to respond to these petitions. You have to answer these questions. That's our right. You're obligated to do that. Sorry, we're not going to participate. And they didn't. We decided, what do we do now? What does the free people do now? Do we quit? Or do we continue? We decided to take a full-page centerfold spread in the Washington Times, the headline we put in there. Dear government, why won't you answer? We laid out the whole story, quoted Jason Furman, and ended up inviting every member of Congress, please send a representative over and meet with us on June 29th at the National Center. No one showed. After the conference, the question, what does the free people do now? What is the appropriate next step for a free people to take? We decided to publish and start putting the story out in USA Today. We signed a contract with USA Today for 12 full-page ads at $67,000 each. We ran four of them. And Katie Emery, the young lady that had our account, she called after we ran four of them. And she said, we can't run anymore. Why not? The tax people have been in talking to our legal people. Tax people, you mean the IRS? She said, yes. And I said, you mean to tell me your legal department has bought everything they said? Well, I guess so. I said, maybe I should come down and talk to your legal department. Maybe they can answer the questions that the federal government won't answer. And she said, she was young and naive, she said, great, I'll set it up. I went down to the headquarters. They wouldn't see me. It was a few days after that, on a Friday night at 7:30, that I got a call from David K. Johnston. K spelled C-A-Y. David K. Johnston was the chief tax attorney for the New York Times for 30 years. And he called me at home at 7:30. He said, Bob, do you know that the Senate Finance Committee has scheduled a hearing on your ads next Wednesday? They're going to be blown up. Your ads are going to be blown up and they're going to be on an easel? And I said, no, I didn't know that. He said, what are you going to do about it? I said, I don't know. What do you do? He said, why don't you call the committee and ask to be a witness at the hearing on your ads? And I said, that's a good idea. So I called the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Grassley's office. And I told him who I was. They said, put your request in writing, fax it down. I did. That afternoon, he responded with a letter signed by him, that said, sorry, the witness list is closed. What do you do now? What does the free people do now? What's the appropriate next step? We decided to take a page out of the Bible. We wrote a letter to the commissioner of IRS. And we said to him respectfully that on this particular day there will be people gathering in Washington at the Jefferson Memorial. We'll then be walking over to the headquarters building of the IRS. It occupies a full block. We say, we'll walk around the building seven times. No trumpet, just that we're going to walk around the building seven times. And then we'll gather at the front door and we'll have a portable speaker system. Please come out and let us know at least when you will answer these questions in a recorded public forum. We were there, we walked, he didn't come out. He didn't answer. What do you do now? We tried everything. What's that, Jim? Oh, Judy reminded me. At the hearing, when he said the witness list was closed, this is important. Thank you, Judy. I went to the, I called Joe Bannister and Bill Benson and a couple of others and said, I think we should go down there anyway. They're saying the witness list is closed. We may not be able to speak, but if we'll try. And if they don't let us speak, we'll submit a statement into the record of the hearing. So we were there. They wouldn't let us speak. But there was a witness on the stand. And she pointed to our ads, which were blown up on an easel. And she said, these people are merely asking you to answer their questions. Maybe you should answer their questions. She said that. Right? It's as though she wasn't in the room. It's as though they didn't hear her. It's as though she vaporized and evaporated. And they went right over her head. We're not going to go there. They were not about to respond to a petition, you know, a citizen's petition for redress of grievances. So, what do you do now? I decided I knew what I needed to do. And so I wrote a letter respectfully to the president and to the speaker and to the Senate Majority Leader. And in very respectful, humble terms, I said that a month from now, on July 1st, I was going to begin a hunger fast in Washington. I would not eat again until the government decided, until they answered these questions in a recorded public forum, or agreed to answer these questions in a recorded public forum. So I got a permit from the National Park Service to park my van and trailer, which had a little sign on it, at 14th and Constitution, just off the street, but on National Park Service property, equidistant from the IRS, the White House, and the Washington Monument. And before I went down, I faxed a one-page flyer to every... I faxed a flyer to every talk show host or every radio station in America. It worked. While I was down there, there were requests coming in from everywhere for an interview. And so I was talking to radio audiences all over the country, and I was saying to them, just call the White House. You will get a live operator. Say to the live operator, don't let the guy die, just answer his questions. And there were thousands of those calls that were received by the White House, thousands. And up until the 19th day of the hunger fast, the position of the government was Bob could come in and talk to the chief counsel at the IRS and the Department of Justice. They could come in and talk to him, but he couldn't bring anybody with him, and he couldn't record the meeting. Of course, I wasn't interested. But on the 19th day, Lawrence Lindsay, head of the Council of Economic Advisors, a major White House department, wrote a note and delivered it in which he said, you will now receive a substantive response from the government, and it would be good if you ended your hunger fast. The next morning, the IRS commissioner called and said, okay, we agree to meet in a recorded public forum and answer the questions. And that afternoon, Ashcroft, the attorney general, did the same thing. I was in Roscoe Bartlett's office, the congressman from... Thank you for that. But the rest of the story is... So I was in Congressman Bartlett's office when the number three man... on that day, the 20th, when Dan Bryant, the number three man at the Department of Justice, called and spoke to Roscoe Bartlett in my presence. And I was I have 20 days without eating. I didn't quite pick up on the significance of this as I should have. But anyway, this is what Dan Bryant said to Roscoe Bartlett. He said, okay, we're going to meet and answer the questions in a recorded public forum. But we do not want history, the record, to show that we are, the government is responding to a citizen's petition for redress of grievances. We want the record to show that we are merely responding to a congressman's letter, so write us a letter. And we sat, and he sat down, and we wrote the letter, then he said, let's go over and deliver it. We went over and we negotiated in Ashcroft's office with Dan Bryant, the number three man there. And we said that we couldn't answer all of these questions in one day. We needed 2 days. They agreed. They said they didn't want this held in a hearing room, or they didn't want it held in a room where anybody could come in off the street and disrupt things. Roscoe Bartlett said, we'll do this in one of the hearing rooms and one of the House office buildings on the Hill, a very secure location. We agreed. We said we didn't want a lot of cameras clicking and all that kind of stuff. We would have one camera crew. You would have one camera crew. That was agreed. We selected and agreed on 2 dates. This was now July 20th. We agreed on 2 dates for this, September 23rd and 24th. And the year was 2001. We had 9/11. On 9/12, we wrote and requested a delay, a postponement. 2 new dates were selected, 2 dates in February. And after this, we went down to the hearing room to inspect it, its wiring and so forth, to see if we could do a live webcast of that hearing on those 2 days. And we determined we could. And we went further. We decided to pay for it. We were breaking new ground. We decided that we would do this on a pay-per-view basis. Anybody could pay $19.95 and watch any one of the 2 days and then get a DVD of the entire hearing at the end. Thousands upon thousands of people signed up. And the government, of course, was watching this. And they pulled out of that hearing. Why they pulled out, I don't know. But they weren't going to be able to control what came out of that room if we were going to do a live webcast. So maybe that's why they pulled out. And we've been trying to get... We held a hearing. I mean, they pulled out, but we went ahead anyway. And we rented the main ballroom at the Washington Monument, Marriott. Sorry. And we did a live webcast. And for 2 days, we put under oath tax professionals, constitutional tax attorneys, including an attorney who, at one point in his career, was in the chief counsel's office of the IRS. 3 former IRS agents, accountants and forensic accountants and so forth. We put them all under oath, and over 2 days, they answered the questions that the government wouldn't answer, proving conclusively that whereas the Internal Revenue laws are constitutional, they're unconstitutional in their application. I'll tell you a cute story. During that 2-day hearing, which was being webcast live, after we, one or two of the witnesses finished testifying, we were taking a short break. And there was a stage where the people who were asking the questions and those who were answering were up on the stage. So I was down below during this brief recess. And David K. Johnston, the New York Times reporter, approached. And he said, gee, Bob, the last time you were in Washington, there were 400, 500, 600 people in attendance. You've only got about 90 or 100 here. What's going on? Are people losing interest in this subject? And I said to him, David, you see this pole over here with the camera on top and this pole over here with the camera on top? There are thousands and thousands of people watching you talk to me at the moment and hearing what you're saying. And he said, what? Can you prove that? And, of course, we were able to prove that. So we've been trying to get that petition for redress of grievances answered, and we've tried repeatedly over the years to get that. We've tried all sorts of things, ways to get the government to respond to that petition for redress of that grievance. There's another one we should spend a couple of minutes on, that one of the many. It's well understood that George Bush wanted to invade Iraq, wanted to go into Iraq from day one of his administration. That's pretty well understood now. But in 2002, the war drums were really beating. And eventually, the White House sent over to Congress its Iraq resolution, which, if passed, would have Congress saying to the president, it's your decision if we go in and when. There isn't anything in the Constitution that authorizes one branch to transfer the power we have given it to another branch. But nonetheless, that's what this Iraq resolution would have Congress do. And so it fell to the House International Relations Committee. All laws, you know, originate in the committee. So it fell to the House International Relations Committee, chaired by Senator Henry Hyde, a person I had a lot of respect for until this happened. He scheduled a hearing on that on October 2nd and 3rd, 2002, months before we went into Iraq. And Ron Paul was on the committee. And on October 3rd, his turn came to speak. And he said to the committee, I have a substitute resolution for your consideration. As soon as he said that, the committee had to vote on his substitute before they voted on the White House's Iraq resolution. And Ron Paul did an admirable job of defending the War Powers Clause of the Constitution, quoting the Federalist Papers, Madison, arguing that the founders worked very hard to make sure that this decision to apply the armed forces of the United States in hostilities overseas would never rest with one man, the president, but would always rest with our representatives. And when he finished, Henry Hyde said this, events have overtaken the Constitution. These clauses, the Constitution, in his words, were, quote, inappropriate and anachronistic. This is not a menu. We don't get to pick and choose which parts of it we like or are going to enforce and which parts we don't like and not going to enforce. The Constitution has to be construed in its entirety. It's all part of a grand design. And yet, we don't change it by simply ignoring it. Article 5 lays out a procedure for amending the Constitution. And here we have, you know, them saying, events have overtaken the Constitution, we can ignore the Constitution. What clearer evidence do we need that there are those in power running the country who believe that the Constitution is meaningless, and that they're not to be, they don't have to be chained down by it, and that what really matters is how many people, one more than half the number of people, voting one way or the other. What clearer evidence do we need that people are acting and behaving as though we are a democracy, where if you don't like what's going on, just vote for somebody else? So, once he did that, once he said that, and then they voted down, and Ron voted against his own amendment, of course, because he was not for invading Iraq. His whole point was, this is what you should be debating. If you pass my substitute amendment, you will be declaring war. He said, this is what you should be debating, not what the White House sent over. So they voted his down, he voted against it, of course, and then they passed the White House resolution. We immediately felt outraged by this, of course, and we felt that we had some evidence that, you know, the government was violating another provision of the Constitution, and so we knew that we had to petition them for a redress of the grievance. And the way we treat these petitions, the ones that, you know, go to these every member of Congress and the president, we treat them as depositions. You know, in any civil matter or criminal matter, each side gets the right to ask the other side any question they want to ask him. And as long as that question relates to the subject matter of the lawsuit, the other side has to answer it. Each side has the ability to get all the evidence that the other side has and is going to use against them in the trial. Well, we approach these petitions for redress of grievances as depositions. Each one of these has a series of questions. Each question is a statement of fact. We don't deal with opinions. We only deal with facts, facts that we can support. And so there's a statement of fact preceded by the words admit or deny. So there's 29 questions or 53 or 89 questions in each of these petitions. Admit or deny this, admit or deny this, admit or deny this, this fact, fact, fact. These questions fall in two categories. This is what you're doing. This is what the Constitution requires. Admit and deny this, this, this. This is what you're doing. Admit and deny this, this is what the Constitution requires. And so we decided we would prepare this and that we would serve it on every member of Congress. Not an easy undertaking. There are 535 members spread over six Senate and House office buildings with multiple stories. It's an enormous undertaking. We put the word out. We're a national organization. People always respond. And they came to Washington. And the night before, we're a whole bunch of us, dozens of us, were at the Washington Plaza. And we're preparing all of these documents. And as long as we were going to go through this exercise, we decided we had the opportunity, we were going to take it, to serve three more petitions for redress grievances. There were three other issues on the minds of freedom-loving people in this country. We decided to prepare a petition for redress of grievances regarding the Federal Reserve System and its violation of the money clauses. And we decided to prepare another one, against the USA Patriot Act and its violation of the privacy clause, the so-called privacy clauses. And one more on the direct unapportioned tax on labor. Now we had four of them to be served. And when we served these petitions for redress of grievances on every member of Congress, the person in the office who was receiving it for that member of Congress signs that they received it, and the person who serves it signs that they served it. So we have all these proofs of service. They can never, and you would be amazed at the number of congressmen who have over the years said, "Well, gee, I didn't get that." And so the person, you know, would say, "Bob, you have evidence? Yeah, here it is." And we fax it down. Oh, yeah. But they still don't respond. They still don't know we're not going to respond. So we've decided, well, we served these four. We said to them, each member of Congress, in writing, we respectfully requested that they send a representative across the street on November 14th, where people from around the country will be gathered on the National Mall, right across the street from the Capitol. Please send a representative over at 2 o'clock on the afternoon of November 14th, and at least let these people know when you will respond to these petitions. And so on November 14th, there were 1,000 of us or so that were there. We caravaned in from different parts of the country. I flew to San Francisco. We drove across. We had a couple of overnights. We had Liberty rallies. It was wonderful. We're all there on the 14th. We had a big stage. We contracted with the staging company that stages all of the main events at the National Mall, including the fireworks. We had constitutional scholars giving speeches. We had music. We had big banners. We had a live webcast of the entire day's events. Thousands of people watching this. And at 2 o'clock, in a very dramatic moment, we asked the crowd to part. Please make room for these representatives who will be coming from across the street to respond to our petition, our four petitions for redress grievances. No one showed. We parted, and no one showed. We're building a record, just as the founders had a record of 11 years of petitioning the government of their day for the grievances. The government was violating their rights. They petitioned for 11 years, from 1763 to 1774. Then they decided that they were going to get together, and their petitions were answered only with repeated injury. And we're in the exact same situation. We've got a documented history here of violation of our rights, attempts to hold them accountable, their refusal to be held accountable over and over again in one way or another. We have we've been petitioning for all kinds of grievances. The federal gun control laws are unconstitutional, most of them. There's no authority in the Constitution to develop a North American Union. We petition for redress of grievances of that. I don't mind. I mean, in stealth, they're developing a North American Union. All the facts support this, which would effectively obliterate the northern and southern boundaries. What's going on here? I don't mind if Mexico becomes the 51st state and Canada the 52nd, and they apply for statehood, and they're approved, and they're allowed in, and they have state constitutions that guarantee their people the same rights that our state constitutions guarantee us. What's going on here? Where do they get this authority? So we petition for redress of agreements of that grievance. We petitioned over this immigration law, the failure of the president to faithfully execute the laws. We've had laws on the books for decades, against illegal immigrants, simply not being enforced. We petitioned computerized vote counting. We have a right not only to vote, but to know that our vote is being accurately counted. To know. The Supreme Court has actually said so. And they emphasize the word know. We have a right to know that our votes are being accurately counted. You don't know that your vote is being accurately counted if it's counted in secret. How could you know? But that's what happens when computers count your votes. They're counted in secret. How do you know that your vote was being accurately counted? You don't. And that's a violation of your fundamental right. Okay? So last September, I was reading in the New York Times that Mr. Paulson and Mr. Bernanke had entered into an agreement to give AIG $85 billion. Wow, I looked in the Constitution. I saw a Commerce Clause. That authorizes the government to regulate business. Where they get the authority to participate in business, to make markets, set prices, which is effectively what they're doing. Where do they get the authority to give or lend public money or credit to any private entity for a decidedly private purpose? It's not there. I didn't want any of that money to move over to AIG until this underlying question was settled. So we drew up the papers, and we went down to the Federal District Court in Albany and filed the papers. By 11 o'clock, the case was filed one morning. And we asked the judge to sign a restraining order. We submitted a proposed restraining order. Sign this order, judge. You know, if he signed it, they would not be allowed to transfer any money until at least there was a hearing on the matter. And under the rules, you have to notify the other side that you've submitted a restraining order to the judge. Gosh, give them an opportunity to call the judge and ask them not to do it. And under the rules, you have to notify the other side. So I got home, and I got on the phone with the lawyers at the Federal Reserve. And I explained to them, you've been sued. You don't have the authority to do this. That's the claim. And to make matters worse, you didn't even go to Congress here. We made a big issue out of that. And I, you know, there's a restraining order before the judge. And Judy, she faxed down the 35 page of the complaint and the restraining order. Then I got on the phone with the lawyers at the Treasury Department. Same thing. You've been sued. This is the nature of the case. You don't have the authority to do this. And so forth, and we fax the papers to them. You also got to do this with their lawyers. So you get on the phone, as we did, with the lawyers at the Department of Justice and got those papers filed. And then, it was that night. So by 3 o'clock, they're all notified. They've been sued. And we're making a big issue out of the fact that not only do you not have any authority under the Constitution to do this, but golly, you didn't even go to Congress. It was that night on television that you saw in this hurry-up meeting last September, behind closed doors, you had Paulson and Mr. Bernanke meeting with the leadership of the House and the Senate, behind closed doors. And when they came out, you saw these long faces, and you saw these politicians saying, oh my gosh, they've just explained that, you know, the roof is the bottom's going to fall out, the sky is falling, credit's going to dry up, everything's going to go to heck in a handbasket. And they promised to come back to us with legislation so that we in Congress could pass it and prevent all this from happening. And they, and a couple of days later, you may recall, Mr. Paulson came back to Congress with a 3-page bill, asking the Congress to pass the bill, pass the law, which would authorize the Treasury and the Fed to print and borrow $700 billion and use it to buy up these private assets. And in that 3-page bill, it said that nobody could challenge this in any administrative agency and nobody could go to court to challenge it. 3-page bill. We immediately drew up another lawsuit. Didn't want any of that $700 billion to pass either. The court consolidated the two cases. That was last September. Then the court proceeded to do what courts do under these circumstances. Cooperate with the other one or two of the other branches in a collective decision to deny us our constitutional rights. They put their foot on the hole. They put their foot out the aisle. They slowed things down. It wasn't until a few weeks ago that the court issued its decision in the case, dismissing the case for lack of standing. And so we appealed it, and we'll give the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan an opportunity to weigh in. And then we'll take it to the Supreme Court. Mark my words, it'll be affirmed, and then the Supreme Court will decide not to hear the case. You know, lack of standing. Your injury is no different than anybody else's injury in the country. You've got a problem, take it up with Congress. Excuse me, my rights are individual rights. So are yours. They don't depend upon the will of any majority. Your rights do not depend upon the will of any majority. Whether it's a majority, one more than half the number of people voting in the polling places, Or one more than half the number of people voting in the halls of Congress? Or one more than half the number of people voting on the bench of the Supreme Court? Your rights are individual rights. And for the court to, you know, dismiss the case saying, you know, your harm is no different than anybody else's, take it up with Congress, get one more than half the number of people thinking and believing the way you do, and maybe you'll get somewhere, it's just absurd. Anyway, so we've been doing this for quite a while. Just as the founders had their capstone grievance, the grievance that capped all the others, the grievance that more than any other led to the signing of the Declaration of Independence, we have our capstone grievance. This is it. In 2004, 1,450 brave people from this country representing all 50 states, we decided that we would file an action for declaratory relief in the federal court in the District of Columbia to ask the court to declare our rights and the government's obligation under the last 10 words of the First Amendment, the Accountability Clause. No court had ever done that before. And so we asked the court to declare our rights. We asked the court to answer two questions. These are the two questions we submitted to the court. First, is the government obligated to respond to citizens' petitions for redress of their violations of the Constitution? Second question, if they don't, do we not then have the right to withdraw our support and resources from that government? Because we don't recognize it anymore. It's not the government we set up. We set them up to secure our rights. We control them by this document, right? So we had these two questions. Now, there's another judicial doctrine. It's a good doctrine, like the standing doctrine, on its face. But the courts, the judiciary, can abuse this doctrine just as much as they abuse the standing doctrine. It's called the doctrine of stare decisis. Two words. S-T-A-R-E-D-E-C-I-S-I-S. It means this. If the Supreme Court lays down a principle of law in one case, and you come along later in time, a week, a month, a year, 100 years later in time, and the facts of your case are similar to the facts of the other case, the earlier case, and the law that you're standing on, the law that you say has been violated, the right that you say has been violated, is the same as the law that was argued in the earlier case, then the principle of law laid down in the earlier case applies to you. It's called case law. It's called precedent. It's a sound doctrine on its face. If this issue has been settled, how many times do we have to settle it? So it's been settled once, and so they quote, you know, the earlier decision in deciding the case against you or for you, whatever. So here we are asking the court to answer these two questions. The federal courts did this. They said, whoops, sorry, the answer to your first question is the government does not have to listen or respond to your petitions. The Supreme Court said so. They said so twice. This is the decision in our case. They said that in 1979 and 1984. So if the government doesn't have to listen or respond to your petitions, then if that's the answer to your first question, then you don't have the right to retain your money until they do. Case closed. What were these two cases? Were the facts of our case similar to the facts of those two cases that the court used to close our case? Was the law we were arguing the same as the law that was argued in those other cases? Or was this another example of judicial corruption? You decide. The first of those two cases that was cited in our case was Smith versus Arkansas, a case that came out of Arkansas. What were the facts of that case? There, the state legislature passed a law saying, public employees in the state of Arkansas, if you have on-the-job related employment-related grievances, you must submit your grievances directly to your public employer. You cannot form an association and have the association submit your grievances. You must submit them directly. In Arkansas, you had a group of highway workers who formed an association. And they used the association to submit their on-the-job related employment-related grievances. And the state said, we don't have to listen or respond to you or even recognize you. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, in this context, the government does not have to listen or respond. What happened in Minnesota? Minnesota versus Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. There, the state legislature passed a law and said public employees in the state of Minnesota, if you have on-the-job related employment-related grievances, you must submit them through your union, your association. You can't submit them individually. Quite the converse of what was going on in Arkansas. And you had six college professors in Minnesota who had on-the-job related employment-related grievances. And they didn't want to submit them through their union. They wanted to submit them directly. They called it free speech. And they did. And the state said, we don't have to listen and respond to you. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found for the state of Minnesota. Now I ask you, are the facts of our case anywhere similar to the facts? Are we public? We're not public employees. These are not on-the-job related employment-related grievances. We are grieving violations of the Constitution of the United States of America by elected officials, federally elected officials. The facts are entirely different. Now, what about the law? The law that we were standing on, was it argued in the earlier cases? Listen to this. We were arguing the original intent behind those words, the people have the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to petition the government for redress of grievances. We were arguing the original intent, because no court had ever declared what it means. So we were arguing the original intent, the historical context and purpose of those words. And we went all the way back to the Magna Carta, and we came forward, and we said, see, this is what it means. And we argued, there's nothing in American history or jurisprudence that contradicts this interpretation. It means if we've got some evidence that they've stepped out of line, outside the boundaries we've drawn around their power, we can petition them for a redress of the grievances. They're obligated to respond, and if they don't, we can withdraw our money and support until our grievances are redressed. This is what that right means. And here's how we arrive at that conclusion, and it's right out of these historical documents and so on. This is what they had in their minds, okay? And Judith Rogers, one of the three judges who decided the case on the Court of Appeals, one step below the Supreme Court, she wrote a separate 9-page decision, opinion in the case. And she said this, I have checked the legal briefs that were filed in this Arkansas and Minnesota cases. This argument before this court, the meaning of the right to petition for redress of grievances, the meaning of this accountability clause, this argument was not argued in those two earlier cases. That should have been the end of this stare decisis application, right? And she went on to say this. It will be interesting to see how the Supreme Court handles this case. Those are her words. When I read that, I was elated. I said, my gosh, this case is going to be heard by the Supreme Court. She didn't. She wouldn't have said that. She wouldn't have gone that far if she and her law clerks had not spoken to the judges and the law clerks at the Supreme Court just down the street. So the skids have been greased. They're going to hear the case, and hallelujah, they're going to have to conclude we're right. The accountability clause means that if we have some evidence that they've stepped outside the boundaries, drawn around their power by the war powers clause and taxes clause and all these other prohibitions, restrictions, and mandates, and doing things that they're not authorized to do, and we call them on it, they're obligated to respond, and if they don't respond, then we can withdraw our money until they do. It's the only nonviolent solution to the problem. Hallelujah. Supreme Court's going to have to conclude that way. Hallelujah. There's going to be this tremendous shift of power from the government to the people where it was meant to be in the first place. Hallelujah. Couldn't wait to get our application into the Supreme Court to hear the case. We got our application in, and the Supreme Court decided the case in one word, denied. They weren't going to hear the case. What is the job of the Supreme Court if it's not to apply the Constitution? This was the first impression case. This deals with our ability to hold on to our system of governance. Without this, if they make it impossible for us to do this non-violently, then the second accountability clause is going to come into play. It's called the Second Amendment. And we're doing everything we can possibly do to prevent that from happening. And you get this kind of nonsense. This is our capstone grievance. It leaves us with no choice but to have this Continental Congress. Three people. Three constitutional, people. Proven passion for the Constitution, getting together from each of the 50 states, discussing these grievances, and settling on some course of action. And then you people in each state doing everything you can possibly do to reach out to other people, to make them aware of this, and help get the dots connected in their minds. They've got to see the Constitution for what it is. They've got to see these patterns of these violations. They've got to see the pattern of people trying to hold them accountable and their non-response, or worse, their retaliation. And that this is a course of action that is justified, whatever the course of action is that these delegates come up with, that it's justified under the, just as the founders' course of action was justified in their day. There is no other way. There is no, if there's another, we have no pride of authorship. If there's some other approach, non-political, you know, you cannot, it's a huge mistake to encourage people to rely on the electoral process to get us out of this mess we're in. It can't be done. The numbers aren't there. Ron Paul just proved it. Every time he spoke the truth, every time he mentioned the Constitution, he lost another block of voters, a large block of voters. There, most of the people in this country have a vested interest in the status quo. For instance, when Ron Paul said, as he said over and over again, the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional, he lost a big block of voters. There's a lot of people who work for these corporations that spring up around central banks. They don't want to hear this. They vote, their spouses vote, and so forth. When Ron Paul said it was unconstitutional to go into Iraq without a declaration of war, and that it's unconstitutional, this foreign policy of interfering in the internal affairs of foreign countries and staging these coups and all this other stuff that we do, that it's unconstitutional. He was right. He spoke the truth. But he lost a large block of voters. There's a whole lot of people, not only who work for companies that supply goods and services, you know, to the military, but there's a lot of people in this country who are influenced by such organizations as the American AIPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, whatever it's called, and that are influenced by. They want us over there. They want a huge block of them. And when Ron Paul says government is too big and needs to be downsized, that they're doing a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing, that they're not authorized to do, he lost a huge block of voters. There's a lot of people who work for government in this country, local, state, federal government. We lost them. So the numbers aren't there. But the point is this, even if the numbers were there, even if it was possible to get one more than half the number of people voting in the halls of Congress, you know, to abide by and protect, interested in primarily in preserving and protecting and enhancing our individual rights, liberties, and freedoms. Even if that was possible, our rights are individual rights. They don't depend upon, they should not depend upon. I shouldn't have to wait until we get one more than half the number of people, you know, voting and in the halls of Congress defending the Constitution. It is wrong. It is absolutely wrong to encourage people to rely on the electoral process exclusively. Yes, we have to, we want a government, we need a government. And yes, we want our we want these officials elected. Yes, we all have a duty to vote. Yes, we have a duty to check these people out and vote accordingly and so forth. Yes, yes, yes. But our rights are individual rights. They don't depend upon the will of any majority. And it's wrong to encourage people to think that way. You fought, when people who encourage us to depend upon the electoral process, they are encouraged. We're falling right into the hands of those people who act and believe that this is a democracy. If you don't like what's going on, just vote for somebody else. It's not the way it's designed to work. It shouldn't work that way. And we shouldn't be encouraging people to rely on the states to get us out of this mess we're in. Where have the states been all these years? The states and the federal government are inextricably intertwined. They've sold their souls for a plate of beans over and over again. The same two political parties seat all of them as seat the people in the halls of Congress. Again, our rights don't depend upon the will of anybody, the will of any majority. They're individual rights. But the problem is the Constitution does not defend itself. Government isn't going to defend it. Corporate America isn't going to defend it. Corporate media isn't going to defend it. It doesn't get defended unless you defend it. And you can't do it alone. You can't do it alone. It takes a mass movement, a critical mass. And so let's, you know, play it by the book. Let's let the world see how some interested minority standing up in defense of the Constitution, trying to hang on to it. And so we think we have to have this Capitol Congress. It will happen this year. There will be 150 delegates. It's up to you to get the best there is. It's up to you to make sure that this, you know, whole process is beyond reproach, that these people in this whole process is as pure as Caesar's wife. You know, and
Caesar's wife.
Wouldn't she kill? Anyway, so at this point, I'll do two things in the time remaining here. I'll do two things. One, I'll answer any question on the Continental Congress, please, on the Continental Congress first, and then any other question. And while we're doing that, if someone would pass a hat for donations to help us offset the cost of this room and everything else we're incurring on our trip, the expenses we're incurring on this national tour. Do that quietly, please. What I hope is every question can be heard. Every question is important. Every question has an answer has to be heard by everybody. So just pass a hat quietly, but I'll take questions on the Continental Congress first. Yes?
Is the capstone interpretation going to be the major issue that you want to get settled at this point?
This is not a... The question was, is the capstone grievance the issue that we want to get settled at this conference or at this Continental Congress? Understand this is not a we the people organization function. We're suggesting it's the appropriate next step. We're doing everything we can to facilitate it. You get three people from every state, that's 150 people that go off to this Continental Congress, and they're going to adopt their own rules, and it's the people's Continental Congress, not ours. All we're trying to do is encourage it or get it off the ground. So what they do, you know, they're being called to address these violations of the Constitution and settle on some course of action. That's the call. All right? And so I hope that you will see them deliberately, day after day, discussing these violations and these attempts to hold them accountable and government's refusal to be held accountable the course of action that is therefore necessary. Yes?
I'm aware of several groups here and there that are kind of thinking along the same lines as you are. What do you recommend so that we all get on the same page?
Yeah. That's important. At this point, I have to give you my rocket ship analogy. Think of Cape Canaveral. There's this rocket. It's very heavy. And there's the payload attached to it. It's very heavy. And it has to get up through the resistance of the atmosphere. No easy task. How does it accomplish that? It's got a chamber with liquid fuel in it. That's where the energy is. It gets ignited. That energy wants to go off in every... It's an explosion. It wants to go off in every conceivable direction, but it can't. That energy is channeled. It can only go one way, and that's out the bottom. That's what you see when you see it fired and lifting off. That mass goes out... The only hole it can go out is out the bottom, and there's an orifice in there. And as that mass passes through the orifice, its velocity increases. And that's the thrust, mass times velocity. And it gets the ship out into space, the rocket out into space. Here's what's happening in the freedom movement. All of us have just so much energy. We're all in this chamber trying to get this freedom ship off the ground, right? But it's as though somebody has drilled holes all the way around the chamber that where all that energy sits. So the energy gets... It's going off in all these different directions. It's not being channeled. If it's not channeled, we can't develop that thrust. It is absolutely essential that these different... I'm amazed. I mean, old enough and from observing these dynamics for a long enough time, I'm amazed at the number of people that are now talking about the Constitution and the individuals and groups that are springing up. It's wonderful. But energy is going off in all of these different directions. We can solve this problem politically. You know, we can influence their behavior and bring them back, you know, by having... don't misunderstand. All of these... You have to be proactive. All of these
marches and tea parties and all these other things are all very important. Don't misunderstand. They're all very important. But you have to have action. There has to be more than this. And it's not a matter, these issues, you know, I was watching these debates, and everybody but Ron Paul, every one of those candidates, talks about all of these issues, war and the economy and immigration, all this stuff, as though they were political questions. They're not public policy questions. They're not political questions. These public policies were settled a long time ago, and they're in concrete. They're set in concrete. These are constitutional questions. And to hear people say it's unconstitutional, if it's unconstitutional, it is not to be tolerated. Period. If it's unconstitutional, it is not to be tolerated. Our job is to do everything we can possibly do to keep them in the boundary. You know? And so, if we don't channel this energy, we're going to lose. Somehow we have to channel this energy. And I can tell you something that is happening now that is giving me great hope, personally. I was at a meeting like this in Savannah, Georgia one night, a few weeks ago. And I was due in Jacksonville, Florida the next night. And so on Tuesday morning, I'm on the road from Savannah to Jacksonville. And I pass this sign that says, Jekyll Island, this way. And so I'm curious. Does anybody not know about Jekyll, the creature from Jekyll Island? You don't. Wow. Just makes sense. There's a renowned documentarian. His name is G. Edward Griffin. He wrote a factual account of what happened in 1913, of an event that went on in 1913. The facts are that back then there were some very prominent people, highly recognizable people, who disguised themselves and got on a train in New Jersey and took the train down to Jessup, Georgia. And then they got on took a 30-minute automobile ride over to Jekyll Island. At that time, Jekyll Island was the retreat for the very, very elite. They owned these little buildings. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and the rest of them. And what did they do there? They got together and they wrote the Federal Reserve Act, which was then introduced and passed.
I believe it was 1910, the Jekyll Island took place. 1913 was the...
When they passed
the Reserve Act.
Yeah, so they... It's an, right. And so, but it was then passed during a Christmas break in 1913. And it's no accident that we got the Federal Reserve and the 16th Amendment at the same time. I'll go into that a little later. But so in any event, he wrote about this. And so here I am seeing this sign, Jekyll Island, and I, of course, know all about what happened back then. And I'm curious. So I said, well, at that time, I'll just go over there. And maybe I could actually stand in the room where the creature from Jekyll Island came from. That's the name of G. Edwin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And so I went over, and I was pleased at what I saw. All of the outer buildings, they're all there. They're all well-preserved. It's a fully functioning resort, open to the public. 155 or so sleeping rooms, restaurants, and conference rooms. So I decided, gee, I wonder if we could have the Continental Congress here at Jekyll Island. Wouldn't that be ironic? And so I'm thinking, well, so I went and talked to the department that, you know, we talked to about these things to find out if it was available. And they said, well, what group do you belong to? And I said, yeah, it's no group, just a bunch of people. And so I found out that except for a meeting of school superintendents, it was available. And the school superintendents meeting, she said, was small enough that they could be moved. So, yes, it was available for 2 weeks on July, beginning on, or it was available beginning the July 4th weekend for 2, 3, 4 weeks after that. So now I'm a little excited.
And I'm thinking about this. My mind's really racing. And I was going to get my van and continue driving to Jacksonville, but instead I decided to, I saw this little pier there, a little restaurant, and I went over there for lunch. So there I am eating some shrimp and thinking about this. And I'm thinking about these meetings that I've been holding and this form that you just filled out, the citizen action form. And there's a question on there, you may remember. It says, what groups do you belong to? What other freedom groups? And, you know, people are listing all of these groups, Campaign for Liberty, and the Fed, Jobbird Society, Constitution Party. All of these different groups are getting listed. Then the next question is, do you think these groups would support the Continental Congress? And a lot of times people are leaving that unanswered. They don't know. Well, gee, I'm thinking, you know, if we can't get the leaders of these groups, and these groups, rather, to come together on this, how are we ever going to get the critical mass, you know, of 15 or 20 million people to understand and to support it? And I said, who could be against this? I mean, it's a bunch of people getting together, talking about these constitutional violations and what we could do about it. It's no threat to the identity of any organization, no threat to anybody's donor base or membership list. Who could be against it? And so I think, well, how could we? So I wondered, do you think we could get the leaders of these groups to get on a train in New Jersey in May to come down to Jekyll Island for a couple of days to help lay the groundwork for the upcoming Continental Congress? Wouldn't that do a lot to galvanize all of these people who for the longest time have been saying, if we can only get everybody together working on something. So I got on the phone, I called G. Edward Griffin, I don't know him very well, and he said, Bob, the Continental Congress idea, I've been watching you talk about this, he said it's a great idea, and the train ride's a great idea, and I'll be on the train. And then I agreed, and I've been calling others, a lot of others, leaders of these freedom-oriented groups, and everyone we talk to says, yes, we'll get on the train, we'll go down to Jekyll Island for a couple of days. And so we've selected a day, the third week of May. And it sure looks, as I stand here tonight, it sure looks like it's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of leaders of these different groups getting together on the third week of May down at Jekyll Island to help lay the groundwork. You know, and I booked 11 rooms with two queen beds in each room and booked the train ride for my wife and I. It's from New Jersey. It's train number 97. If anybody's interested, it's train number 97. It leaves New York around 3 in the afternoon, goes over to Newark, New Jersey. That's where we'll get it. And because we want to follow in the footsteps. And then it's an overnight. You have the choice of just sitting in the coach car or a sleeper. And so we'll take the sleeper and we'll arrive at 7 o'clock on the morning of the Thursday morning. So we'll have all day Thursday there with an early check-in. And Thursday night, Friday, with a late checkout, and we'll get on the train around 7 o'clock out of Jessup to head back on that Friday. And so others are being invited, and everybody seems to think it's a good idea, and they're expressing their commitment to attend. So it looks like it might happen. And so here's a positive sign, at least, that we're able to get, you know, a number of these groups together.
So this is not the Continental Congress. Itself.
No, it's not the Continental Congress. No,
this
not
is a predecessor.
Yeah, it's just a meeting up front, some of the leaders, to help, you know, in the outreach effort, to get enough, a number of other people paying attention and helping do their part to get the word out. Yes.
Yeah, I was curious. I mentioned Article 5, and you kind of dismissed it as a possibility, as you stated that Article 5 is part of the Constitution.
Yes.
Now, given the fact that the states under the convention, the proposed amendments on Article 5 convention, submitted 750 applications for a convention from all 50 states, well in excess of the 34 necessary, that the amendment issues that they have covered pretty much deal with all of the issues that you've brought up here tonight as far as petitions and so on and so forth. For example, these states have asked for a federal initiative referendum recall amendment. They've asked for repeal of the federal income tax. They've asked for a balanced budget. They've asked for removal of federal mandates. They've asked for several other issues, all of which do deal with the issues that you're describing. And given that
a federal lawsuit filed by myself in 2004 went to the Supreme Court, and that the basis of all of this rejection of the Supreme, of the Constitution was based on the fact that that lawsuit stated specifically and emphatically that the Supreme Court, that the Congress of the United States, under the political question doctrine, had the right to veto the Constitution, and that the members of Congress were in criminal violation of their oath of office in doing so. And this was admitted by the Solicitor General of the United States in his official capacity, both as Solicitor General and as Attorney of Record for each member of Congress, which included such people as Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Ron Paul, to name some. I'm curious as to why you apparently are not in favor of using the amendment process to solve the issues, given that that is a legitimate constitutional legal method of which the Congress is obligated to call and has been stated by the Supreme Court.
Right. No, I understand. There is Article 5. I'm familiar with it. One way to amend the Constitution is have the states call a constitutional convention. Here's my position.
No, on Article 5, Commissioner, let's get the words correct. The Constitutional Convention is not authorized by the Constitution. The Article 5 Convention is to amend the Constitution as it stands. Constitutional Convention is to amend the Constitution.
So that makes my point even better, I think. Here's my view on this. I really don't think, and with respect to the work that you've done and your opinion, but I don't believe that we should be spending any time thinking that an amended constitution is going to garner any more respect and support from the elected federal officials than the one we now have. What makes you think that they would respect an amended constitution any more than they respect the one we now have? I don't think they will.
In answer to your question, the fact of the matter is that you could write amendments which would specifically deal with their refusal, which you don't have right now. For example, you talk about the right of redress. You could amend the Constitution, theoretically, by making it that they are required to.
So we have a choice, to follow your logic here. We basically have a choice. We could do it, the people can get together, discuss these, and settle as the final arbiters of the Constitution, which we are. We can get together and settle on some course of action that is aimed at ending and in fact reversing some of these constitutional violations to teach them or to get their respect and get them to honor the Constitution before we talk about any further amendments, because they
or
might
come. Or we can obey the Constitution and call a convention.
Which is obeying the Constitution as it is written now.
Right.
This is
so
our right.
So why are you both obeying the Constitution?
No.
Does anyone else
no.
get to ask a question?
Well, is this not of interest?
Well, it seems
just a show of hands.
Mr. Show.
Shall we continue with this or not?
Let me.
I'm sorry. One way to settle this. We'll try to shorten it up.
Go on.
Just raise your. I'm going to ask those who want us to continue with this to raise their hands. Those who wish we would handle it some other way, raise their hand. But first, those who want us to continue this discussion, raise your hand. And those who would rather we did not. Well, it's pretty close. All right, we're going to spend two or three more minutes, I promise. Okay, is that all right with you? Yeah.
Let me give one piece of information so that people can read this. You can go to the website www.foavc.org. FOAVC.org and read the actual applications, the text of the applications, the 758 applications from the states. You will find in the 1790 application by Virginia a discussion of Congress which states emphatically that there is no vote, there is no debate, nothing. Congress must call a convention. And as I stated, the Solicitor General of the United States stated before the Supreme Court, as a matter of fact and law, in other words, I did get a redress on my petition, that as what I've just stated is correct.
Right.
In other words,
okay.
The solution that you're looking for is amendments. The states have done their job. They have dealt with these problems 50 or 60 years ago.
This gentleman has been before the Supreme Court three times.
That's what he's talking about.
Can I ask you something?
Can I make a quick announcement here before more people trickle out, okay? The URL and the cards that I'm giving out is to a podcast that I do. I'm going to take this recording that we're making of everything I say. I'm going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb. I'm going to find every web reference and every reference that you make or whatever, and I'm going to put that with the MP3 on the web so you can just click down and look at anything we talked to tonight, and you can come to there as a kind of a hub to get this information and look at it deeper so we don't have to resolve every little detail tonight. Just mention a web reference or something, say it clearly, I'll get it on there, I'll find the link, I'll put it out there for you, and we can all learn, okay? And then take a card when you leave so you have that URL with you. Okay,
just thank you. And just to close on this, and then we'll move on. If this states were to, enough of them were to, the requisite number were to call for a federal constitutional or Article 5 convention, and if they said to the rest of us that the purpose of it would be for recall and all these other things that you've indicated that they have said it would be for, I wouldn't want to wait for that process. Time is of the essence here. We've got a government that is totally out of control. This is going to be, it's only going to get worse here as we go forward. They're going to be proposing pulling rabbits out of the hat and so forth. We've got to get on with this. I would not want to put this off and wait for that. Plus, they may say that this is why they want a constitution, an Article 5 convention. But if they were to get it, you can't hold them to that. There's no way to hold them to that. So that.
Mr. Dirk, so they have in the Constitution stated twice, it's the only phrase stated twice in the entire Constitution, that an amendment to the Constitution can only be proposed to the current Constitution.
Yeah.
Repeated once for the
proposal. No.
Same power exists for Congress.
That's not what I said. When they get there, when you get there, they may not wrap their minds around those same issues.
They may not.
Right.
Well, that's why ratification
exists. We'll do what we're going to do, and you're going to do what you're going to do, and I just don't think that that's much of a solution.
Your main point is that the Constitution should be obeyed.
Yes.
Article 5 has been satisfied. Why do you say that we shouldn't obey Article 5? That's what it comes down to. You always oppose obeying Article 5.
Okay.
My question is, how can you suggest that the Constitution as a whole should be obeyed, and yet you sit and do the same selective vetoing that you're accusing the government?
Well, excuse me. Has Article 5 been obeyed?
No.
What makes you, has it been disobeyed?
Yes.
Article 5 has been disobeyed?
Yes, sir.
In what way?
They refuse to call a convention.
Congress
refuses to call a convention. If you read the application...
But what does it take for them to call a convention?
34 applications.
Excuse me, hold it. One at a time, please.
34 applications.
And have they gotten 34 applications?
758.
Excuse me?
758 applications.
Once you sign, you cannot rescind.
Now, that's not true.
Yes, sir.
We're going to have to talk about this later. I mean, this is not something we're going to settle here tonight. There's no time.
It sounds like two parallel complementary efforts.
Yes.
I wanted to just throw a little bit of fuel on this fire and not keep it busy for me, but to throw a little more on it. My understanding of my opening remarks tonight concern the exigency of the situation. I mean, I read today that Tim Geithner is getting ready to spend another $4 trillion in the TARP program. The G20 did, in fact, adopt special drawing rights, SDRs, which is an international currency. They did adopt the FSB, which is an international organization that will govern all of our banking and all of our corporations. They have nationalized GM. They have nationalized most of the banks. They're planning on nationalizing their insurance companies. There's no constitutional authority for that. The U.S. Supreme Court has not made a constitutional decision since John Roberts took the bench. and the decisions that were made previously with David Souter writing them and Ruth Bader Ginsburg writing them, those decisions were full of bias. They cited international law. They cited international precedent, totally ignored stare decisis, and were making political decisions only while they gutted the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment. So my point is this. We're in a situation right now where the exigency, I believe the exigency is so severe. The recent nominee to the head counsel position for the State Department is a lawyer who is an express transnationalist who intends on replacing the Constitution with international treaties through the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Conventions on the Rights of Women. This will be replaced by this administration. The proposal, in my opinion, it will be on the table to replace the Constitution as an organic document in this country within 30 days. And they're not going to be seeking congressional approval, and they're not going to be seeking the approval of the states, because Congress has already ratified those treaties. Congress has already ratified those treaties with exceptions, and the administration is just going to remove the exceptions and then present to us that we're going to join the family of nations under international law, and we're going to abandon this sexist, racist artifact known as the U.S. Constitution. And so the question that arises, and it's the question that I put to this group earlier in the evening, and it's the question that's on the table here. And I've seen this because I'm involved in this movement myself, and I got the National Grand Jury Movement, and I'm in contact with a lot of other people that are doing a lot of other movements. I brought a constitutional challenge to Barack Obama's presidency on the NDC issue. And so the question is this. When you look at all of these different venues, and I have seen this, I saw it in the NBC issue, it's people spending their time attacking one another, cutting the legs out from one another,
right,
and saying, my camp, not your camp, my camp, not your camp.
And not doing a damn thing.
And the truth of the matter is, look, we all have functions, and we all have a focus, and the problem is this, and let me go back to your rocket analogy for just a second, Bob. You watch the Saturn V come off the platform, the most powerful rocket ever built in the United States. There were five engines on the bottom of that, right? You'd agree there's five engines. And so even though we have a situation where all that thrust has to be pushed downward, it's possible for us to have a litigation arm to this, and the litigation arm is, of course, one of the issues is the NBC, another issue is the Article 5, particularly the litigation side of it. Another issue is this petition for redress. And I think this petition for redress, I mean, we have very few choices with it. And quite often the movement is co-opted, and it's going to be co-opted by subterfuge within the movement. In other words, let's have a party concerning our constitutional issue. We'll all get together and have a feel-good time instead of keeping our nose to the grindstone and paying attention to what needs to be done. And this is going to happen, and this is what happened in the Tea Party movement. You know, Glenn Beck, I admire what he's doing, but Glenn Beck put together the 9/12 Commission.
All right, Steve. All right, what's your name again, sir?
Bill Walker.
Bill Walker. I think I understand a little better. Your argument is that the Constitution is being violated.
No, I'm stating that the Solicitor General of the United States stated the Constitution is being violated. There's a difference.
No, I understand. Your argument is the Constitution is being violated. Some people have said so.
Including the official statement of the United States
government, representing
the government.
That's
a significant point.
Well, all right.
When the federal government...
The principle of the matter is the Constitution is being violated. The fifth article is being violated. That's correct. Your argument. Thank you. We've been arguing tonight that the War Powers Clause is being violated and all these other provisions are being violated. So we're calling a Continental Congress to discuss these issues and settle on a course of action. So the violation of Article 5 is on the table along with all these other violations. And we need a Continental Congress to discuss these and settle on a course of action. Unless the people of this country get together... Look, I don't know what these delegates are going to recommend. Because I can't speak to that.
But I can tell... His concept may well be one of the recommendations.
Yeah. Well, sure, it may be, as well as the recommendation that the people of this country withdraw their resources and support from the federal government until these grievances are ended and in some cases reversed, including the one that you're focused on. Okay?
Yeah. For example, you talk about Barack Obama, you people mentioned that, and I don't think it'd be really popular, so I'll repeat it. Barack Obama violated, according to his own attorney of record, federal criminal law. That federal criminal law states emphatically
which
Barack
one?
Obama cannot hold federal office.
Now, we understand that. So, any other questions about
it? For your information, that's in USC 7311.
All right, we need other questions about the Continental Congress.
Yes.
Yes.
How will order be held?
How will order be their own rules? They'll be parliamentarian. And security will also be protected. Yes.
You suggest a way, because there's going to be a lot of people, more people that are here in this group, probably want to be involved with this, who may want to be a representative. So I'm assuming there's going to be some kind of an election.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have, I can't get internet here tonight. You have to have a UW registered computer in order to access the internet. So what I had hoped to put up here tonight. You might want to write this down. It's www.wethepeoplecongress.org. That's the website for the We the People Congress. On that front page, on that home page, there's some links near the top. One of those links is the procedure for nominating and electing delegates. Then there's a link to actually nominate somebody. Hundreds of people have already been nominated for delegates from their state. What we're doing is we hire a company and pay them to tell us on each one of these nominees, are they who they say they are? That's all we want to know. Then we turn that over to the states, to the state coordinators and their team. And those of you who have offered, you know, to help out will be called upon, you know, from time to time to help with these different tasks. But we'll then turn that over to the states. You people then will complete the vetting process. And you people then, the people in each state, will then decide, okay, these are the nominees. You'll place them on your state website. There are now 50 state websites. You'll place them there. And then there will be a period for voting coming up. And people will be asked, concerned people, concerned about the direction this country's going, will be asked to vote by affidavit. Paper ballots, hand-marked, hand-counted. And then people will vote from that list of nominees that you place on your state website. You'll be satisfied first that these are the kind of people that have the credentials and so forth. And you'll make a decision as to who's going to be a nominee to be voted on. And you'll place those people on your state website. Those who do not, some nominees have said they can afford to go there and back and pay their way, pay there for their lodging and for their food and so forth. Others may not be able to, but they'll be highly qualified. So one of the tasks of the people in the state is to develop a fund to help these people if they need help. But also, as you reach out to people, you're going to incur some expenses that you may need to be reimbursed. And so you need a fund, you know, to do that. I mean, we'll be there to backstop, but it's really going to be up to the people. And so there's three tasks: outreach, delegate selection, and this fundraising to help the delegates. Yes?
May I ask you a question on the very beginning, your grievance? Why is it that a lot of people are like, there are 30-some cases against Obama's eligibility? Why can't we use that redress thing against him?
We did. Yeah. All right, you've raised the question, I'm going to go through it.
Okay.
You've raised the question, I'm going to answer it. It's going to take a couple of minutes. About a year ago, I heard these rumors that Mr. Obama was not eligible. And I discounted them. I said, that's just sour grapes. That can't be.
I'm sorry, you did what?
Discount. It can't be. The guy's a senator, blah, blah, blah. That's just sour grapes. I didn't pay any attention. Then I read Judge Sirik's decision. Before I put his decision down on the table, I knew there was something here, that there was something wrong here. Judge Sirik is a federal judge in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. He decided the case brought by Phil Berg. Phil Berg laid out all of this evidence. Now, look, people are entitled to legal arguments. Even we, when we deal with the government in these petitions, we're entitled to our legal arguments. We're not entitled to our version of the facts. Nobody is. In any civil, criminal matter, we're not entitled. It's up to the other side to refute the facts and offer their own. All right? And so here's Mr. Berg, and he lays out all these facts. And based on those facts, he asked the judge to dismiss the case because he's not eligible. What's him off the ballot? Judge, now, the defendants are Barack Obama and the DNC. And they have the right, it's a civil case, so under the federal rules of civil procedure, they could ask the court to dismiss the case for any one of, I don't know, 12 reasons.
Standing.
And
just like you said to him, both of
them. Can I finish? It's so sorry.
Well, and I've got a hell of a tailbone that's cracked. I want to get the answer. No. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
All right, so Barack Obama and the DNC are the defendants. And they have a right to ask the court to dismiss the case on the basis of any one of these 12 reasons. What he could have done, what he did not do, was submit some evidence of his eligibility to the judge and then ask the judge to dismiss the case because Mr. Berg has no case. That's not what he did. Instead, he asked the court to dismiss the case because Mr. Berg has no standing. And that's what the judge did. Now, as soon as I saw that, I knew there's something wrong here. And so I started paying more attention to this issue. I noticed, for instance, there was this case filed in Hawaii. And there, Mr. Martin asked the court to direct the Hawaiian officials to provide access to his vault copy of his original birth certificate because Mr. Obama said he was born in Hawaii. The original birth certificate would have three signatures on it. The attending physician, the local registrar, and the one of the two parents was required to sign the original. And it would also have the name of the hospital, the ages of the parents, and where those parents were born. And so he only asked the court to direct the officials to provide access to that. We all have just one copy, or original. It's in a vault in the state where you were born. And the judge dismissed the case in part, large part, because he said that would be an invasion of Mr. Obama's privacy, which is absurd. I mean, we're talking about the Constitution, the highest office in the land. Serious consequences can befall the country if somebody is not there legally making these decisions. And so, and then I also noticed that there was a case by this guy, Leo D'Onofrio. And I really enjoy reading these legal briefs by lawyers that deal with provisions of the Constitution that have not ever been declared, you know, their first impression cases. No court has ever declared the meaning of the Natural Born Citizen Clause. And so he did a really outstanding job of explaining what the intent of the framers were when they put the words there. It all backed up. And so he went to court and he asked the judge to order the Secretary of State of New Jersey to take three people off the ballot because they didn't satisfy the meaning of the Natural Born Citizen Clause. He said to be a natural born citizen, according to, you know, the original intent, the historical context and purpose of those words, both parents have to be born, both parents have to be U.S. citizens and you have to be born on U.S. soil. So he asked the judge to dismiss three people from the ballot because he said none of them are natural-born citizens. Mr. Obama, Mr. McCain, and there was a third guy on the ballot, born in Nicaragua, in this country on a green card. You know, he's on the ballot, too. And he didn't get anywhere. And so I decided, okay, to round out the record, we're going to petition Mr. Obama directly. We're going to petition him for a redress of this grievance directly. And what we did was we took out a full-page ad in the Chicago Tribune. And the Chicago Tribune has a daily circulation of 540,000 people. And it's his hometown newspaper. And on December 1st, he was operating, Mr. Obama was operating out of the Kuczynski Federal Building in Chicago. His transition team was operating. We hadn't yet reached December 15th, where the states were then going to, the electors were going to cast their votes. And so we published, at a cost of tens of thousands of dollars, we published two of these, one on December 1st and one on December 3rd, an open letter to to Barack Obama. Are you a natural-born citizen of the U.S.? Are you legally eligible to hold the office of the president? And in here, we very respectfully summarize The facts from Mr. Byrd's case, the case that the court dismissed for lack of standing, never reached the merits of the case, and we also summarized the adverse consequences that could befall the country if somebody illegal is holding that office illegally. We asked him respectfully to authorize the Hawaiian officials to provide access, because it's a matter of privacy, only he could do it, please provide access to your original birth certificate. And please make arrangements to deliver some documents to the National Press Club on Monday, the 8th of December, by 10 o'clock. Some documents which, according to Mr. Byrd, you've ordered sealed, meaning your applications to Occidental, Harvard, and Columbia, which would have some citizenship information on it, as well as some passport information. He did not respond. There was no response from him to any of this. This is part of the record that we have been establishing. It rounds out the record. And other people have been doing good work pursuing this in court. Orly Tates and Steve and many others have been trying to get this issue resolved. But that's... That, and, you know, all the evidence suggests that he has refused every attempt to provide some evidence.
How can you refuse a subpoena from the Supreme Court and get away with it? Nothing happened.
They haven't ever issued such a subpoena, and that's the key part that ties into this redress agreement. Both my case and Steve's case and all the other cases that went before the courts were dismissed for either technicalities or, in some cases, behind closed doors with no words like Steve's other than dismissed.
Right.
That's it. So, for record,
let me tell you.
Key point: this redress of grievance is fundamental to our problem.
Yeah,
and that's and it's also important to understand that, in my opinion, and I think Steve will agree with me on this, there is not a litigation solution. Okay,
too bad.
There is not a litigation solution to this issue or almost any other issue. The court, all the way through the court from the superior courts at the local level to the courts of appeals, to the Supreme Courts in the states, to the Federal Courts of Appeals, to the U.S. Supreme Court, that there are corrupt from one end to the other and absolutely
refuse. Let me tell you a related true story. Just to show you, help you understand what's going on. This transition from a constitutional republic to a democracy. I told you about this fellow, Leo D'Onofrio. He brought his case. He's an attorney in New Jersey. He was the one that did the research on the original intent, and he went to court. He asked the court to order the Secretary of State to remove three people, right? Well, they denied. They dismissed the case, and he got to the Supreme Court in record time. So now the Supreme Court has the case. They're going to decide whether they're going to hear the case. The United States, the judges of the Supreme Court meet every Friday, and they decide which cases they're going to hear. And they announce their decision by at 10 o'clock the following Monday. So here it is, December 5th. The D'Onofrio case is the first one to reach the Supreme Court. It's on their agenda. They're going to decide on December 5th whether they're going to hear the case, right? So I'm watching the Today Show in the morning, and there's Pete Williams, the NBC correspondent for NBC. His beat is the Department of Justice and the Supreme Court. And he's given a report. For the first time, NBC is mentioning that there's this question of eligibility. And they're mentioning that this case is on the agenda, the conference that day. They're going to decide whether to hear the case. He then says this. They won't hear this case because they are not going to want to overturn the will of the voters.
Extortion.
I mean, the Constitution doesn't matter. 65 million people voted, that's it. If you don't like what's going on, vote for somebody else. Get somebody else. I mean, that's what you do in a democracy, in a pure democracy. The founders specifically eschewed a democracy. They spit that out. They would have nothing of it.
Mob rule.
They rejected it. Yeah. Decision by the majority, mob rule, they wouldn't have anything.
So far away.
You know, and so here we are. No, there's never been a democracy that didn't commit suicide.
It's true.
And we're on our way.
It's true. It's a fact.
That's a fact.
A little different question here. You're doing a fabulous job over more than a decade. Aside from our small contributions at meetings like this, how do you fund this all these efforts to buy these advertisements?
Okay, good question. When I decided 30 years ago, that little case involving a town and county, and they set up a Tri-County Taxpayers Association, we made the decision, we had put a lower level of our home. We had 2,000 square feet of offices when I started my consulting company. And we decided to make that available to the Tri-County Taxpayers, and it's where we've operated ever since. We do not write it off. We do not charge any of the organizations any rent or anything of that sort. We just make it all available and all the equipment available. We operate out of there. Judy and I, my wife, we're in that office every single day, all day long. We have no annual budget. The way we've always operated, and we've raised and spent, neither one of us, we take absolutely no compensation. So there's none of that overhead that a lot of organizations have. We have never taken a nickel. I can never take a nickel for defending anybody's liberty. I just can't do it, right? So there's none of that salaries and that kind of stuff that a lot of organizations have. And so the way we've operated without an annual budget all these years is when there's something that we feel it needs to be done, whatever it is, we make the case, we think this is the appropriate next step, and we say to people, this is what we recommend, this is what we think is necessary, this is what it's going to cost, donations, please. And the donations have always come in. Millions of dollars we have spent, doing this work. And it's just, and that's how we've operated. Purely on we say, this is what's necessary, and so please help out. We did that with these ads. We put out the call for money, and it came, and we ran the ads. This is how we operate. There's no annual budget. Whenever we need the money for our taxes or something, we just sell another 2 acres of our land. We won that case when they tried to prevent us from developing.
I mean, this is basically just a series of small people making small contributions.
And we have no financial angels. I'm telling you, we have no financial angels. There's nobody making big dollar contributions. When we wanted to do this case with the 1,450 plaintiffs in that case to test the attitude of the judiciary and get a declaration of our rights under the First Amendment, there were 1,450 plaintiffs. I was one of them. I could represent myself because I do this all the time. And I want to get a copy of all the papers. And I want to talk directly to the court. But everybody else, I can't represent them. I can't lawyer for them. So they needed a lawyer. So we said we need $285,000 to hire this lawyer to represent them. And the money came in. And there's no financial angels. It's small donations from a lot of people. And that's how we've always operated. And we've been audited by the IRS. They came up and they audited thoroughly. And everything's fine.
Is that $7 we donate to your outfit?
There is a membership form in the back of this brochure.
We
brought it up.
I
don't know what this is in the back here. It's something else. There is a membership form. You can join for $7 a month. There's other options there. Our policy is always this. If somebody wants to be a member, they don't have the money. All they have to do is tell us and they're a member. Anything on our website, we document everything we do. We make it available. Recordings of every public meeting we've ever held, whatever. We make it available. If people don't have the money, all they have to do is tell us and we send it to them.
You better get somebody to do it. Deduct it from my account because you're late.
I'm late in doing money.
Yeah. It takes $7 per month,
right? Yes, right.
You didn't miss me this month. What's going on?
Well, it's automatic. I don't know what could have happened. But
probably a banking crisis.
Yes.
Okay, yes, ma'am.
I have a question. I'm not really sure exactly how to word this, but...
All right, can we have the question heard, please, by everyone so you need to...
I have a question about the entities that we're addressing and what applies to them. And it's been 2 years that I've been studying law and the courts and gotten entangled with all this. And just some of the things that I'm learning, and I don't quite understand it all and know it all. De jure government, at some point, was that bankrupt?
At some point, did that stop existing? We have a de facto government. Has that been bankrupt all along? And if the entity is bankrupt, how does any of this apply?
Yeah. I understand these arguments. I say two things in response. And there's numerous of these arguments.
I'm in the inquiry, so...
Yeah. There's two ways, two responses. First, any act of Congress or the President that is repugnant to the Constitution is null and void. So I think they've done something, but if it's repugnant to the Constitution, it's null and void. The other argument, and the other thing I would say is this. If this is true, and that's why they do what they do, in violating this provision of the Constitution or that provision, then fine. I want them to tell me that. Then I'll deal with that. But any official, when you have a duty to speak and you don't, then that's either fraud or it's admission. Silence is admission.
Right.
And so I want them to tell me, hey, this is why we're doing what we're doing. This is the answer to your questions. This is the answer to your petitions. They did not nullify, as far as I'm concerned, they did not nullify any of our natural rights. I'm still alive.
Right.
I still have them.
But if we no longer have the government entity that the Constitution provides for, if we don't have that any longer, is there something...
Wait a minute. Who says we don't? It's right here. I can read... No, I'm saying...
They just don't
I can pay. Read it. I mean, this... I can... It's here. I can read and comprehend.
If we no longer had a quorum, before the Civil War, the Southern states walked out, and now there's no quorum. How's their government?
It's a good question. The answer is that you've had a continual usurpation of power in what Bob is calling null and void acts. It's ultra virus acts. The government has moved into tyranny when it oversteps the bounds of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment is a tyrannical amendment. And the imposition of the 14th Amendment on the states is what Justice Rehnquist said was a transmogrification that was totally unjustified in law, that applied constitutional restrictions on the federal government were suddenly being applied to the states. And now we're embarked on, of course, almost pure tyranny, which we're going to get to very soon. But the truth is that the constitutional, and this business about bankruptcy and that kind of stuff, forget it. The country may be bankrupt in the eyes of some European bankers, but there is no federal court that's ever adjudicated the nation as being bankrupt. And so consequently, as a matter of our sovereign law, we're not a bankrupt entity. What we are is a constitutional republic with a government that is way out beyond its boundaries.
And it's our fault. We've allowed it to happen. It's high time that we got together and stood together and pushed back. And before the whole world, one thing the government doesn't like, in my long experience, living out of government, they don't like bad press. They're going to get a lot of it here. The question is going to come. Suppose this is going to be we can't leave here with this unresolved issue, so I'm going to have to address it. Let's say the delegates decide the only nonviolent way is to withdraw our support. And people have to begin to withdraw their support. And yes, there are all these practical questions like withholding and all that you got to get around, but you got to work your way through. But let's say they do that. And let's say there's 15, 20 or more million people. Do we have the people power that's required? And they say, this is the only way to do it. I mean, it's justified, it's our right to do this, and we're going to do it. And 15 to 20 million people decide, okay, including a lot of paymasters, a lot of people that pay, money to people for their labor. And so now you have this huge block of voters, huge block of people who have decided to act in that way. The next question is going to be, I'm surprised nobody's asked again, is next, what's the government going to do? Are they going to clamp down or are they going to stand down? If they clamp down, you're going to then see the ball's going to go to the people's court. What are they going to do? I think you're going to then begin to see what you see routinely in Latin and third South American, Latin American countries, third world countries, you're going to see that level of that kind of violence. And it would just break my heart. Just, you know, we got to that point, okay? It would be... I have a lot of faith in fellow man, and I believe they'll do the right thing. But remember this. The magazine section, Parade, the magazine called Parade, that's in your Sunday newspaper, do they still have that around here?
There was a
photo on that Parade cover years ago that stuck, that really was etched into my awareness. It was that photograph of the bridge going into Selma. And these marchers were told they couldn't march, and they did anyway. So here you had this long line of mostly people of color, mostly in their Sunday best, side by side on the sidewalk on the edge of the road, marching into Selma. They were told they couldn't. And when they got over the bridge, they were met by the government. The government's hoses and their dogs. And you've seen all of these historical clips of this stuff. But those images arrived on television sets all over this country and overseas. And everybody's sympathy immediately went to the people against the government. And it was a huge turning point in that whole struggle for civil rights. And so if the government is going to clamp down, they're going to do it. If we do our job right, again, it's up to the people of each city. But if we do our job right, a lot of people in this country, around the world, are going to be following this. And they're going to see these, you know, rational, intelligent people talking about this and concluding, you know, and arriving at this decision, which they have every right to do. This is their right. And look at what they're defending. So if the government's going to clamp down, they're going to have to do that in the face of a lot of public opposition.
History repeats itself.
We'll see.
Show pictures.
Any other questions? Yes.
Suppose we get 20 million people to withhold their money. We're dealing with a government that has no qualms about issuing money by the trillions.
All right, this is an important question. I'm going to answer it real quick. The question, I'm surprised it took so long to get out. Is the government really going to care? They're just going to print more. Let me tell you, I've got a background in public finance. It's a matter of lender security. It's no accident that we got the 16th Amendment with the intention of the people behind it and the Federal Reserve in the same year. You may not know this, but the Secretary of State, who fraudulently declared the 16th Amendment to have been properly ratified, his name was Philander Knox. That is where the word philandering comes from. Before he became Secretary of State, and before he made that decision, he held like the Attorney General's position, and before 1913, before 1909, In Honduras, the government was going broke. And so they went to the international bankers to borrow money. The bankers said, okay, if America guarantees it, lender security. America said, okay, provided that we control you do as we tell you in terms of your tax policy. And we want you to tax the labor of the people in Honduras, as a way of making sure that we, the guarantee of this debt, are not going to lose a nickel, right? And so they did that. Right on the hard on the heels of that, the rebels in Nicaragua wanted to overthrow the government. And so they wanted to finance their revolution. They went to the international bankers. The bankers said, okay, if America supports it. America said, okay, if we control your tax policy. And they did. So they taxed the labor of the people. So there was the model for what happened here. It's no, and here's how it works. Say the government needs $70 billion and wants to invade Iraq. It doesn't have $70 billion laying around, right? So it prints it, as you say. It just prints $70 billion. And let's say they're all $100 bills. And let's say, you know, it costs 3 cents for the ink and the paper to make each $100 bill, which isn't far off, right? So now the government has $70 billion of $100 bills. Do they then use it to pay whatever the soldiers, buy the tanks or whatever? No. what the Federal Reserve buys it. They buy it for the cost of the paper, so 3 cents a bill. Now they got a $100 bill that they paid 3 cents for. They don't really even see the 3 cents, but maybe that's the deal. So now they got all the $70 billion, $100 bills. Do they then put it into the economy and use it to pay the soldiers and their salaries and buy the tank? No. They lend it back to us. And we agree to pay the $100, which they never put up in the first place, plus the interest determined by them. And it's the income tax that pays that. So if you stop paying, you know, 15 to 20 million people on Monday, stop paying, you know, the tax, believe me, on Tuesday, it's going to be another 15 million. They don't know why. They think that's a good idea. They're going to stop paying too, right? And so it's going to have this huge impact. Believe me, they can't continue. If the last time I checked, the budget that was, federal budget was $2.5 trillion when I looked at this number, 86% of the $2.5 trillion came from the individual income tax. The corporate tax was down 10% and shrinking. So 86% of the $2.5 trillion was coming from the individual income tax, paying the interest on the debt and the transfer payments, money that was transferred from people who earn it to people who don't. So it would have a huge impact. Yeah, they can run the printing presses, but without, you know, some assurance that they're going to get their money back, who's going to, you know, what are they going to do with it? So it's going to, it will have a huge impact.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay. Thank you. Is the libertarian still here? I got a card.
Well, there you have it, the end of a long meeting. A long story because the government refuses to answer some questions and refuses to hear cases. And it gets more and more complicated to explain this to people and to get people to sit down for 4 hours to get the whole story. I hope this podcast helped to get Bob's word out. I have documented this as best I can with links all through the notes for this show. Please point your friends to this or to Bob's website. It's all in writing if you want to read. Some people like me are reading challenged, a little slow, and I like it in audio form. So I hope this new format will just make another way for Bob's message to get out. It's really critical, and we're at a critical time. And we the people have to step up and start working. We can't be little babies anymore, and we can't just sit around and let other people do the work. We have to take responsibility. I know there's many people with arguments that it's not their job for some other reason. God authorizes all authority, and therefore we don't. Whatever authority is in power is authorized by God, and therefore we shouldn't. Object to it. Caesar and God's stuff are separate. It's not my business. Blah, 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 blah. In this nation, it is your business. In this nation, the only nation that was founded by a constitution with limitations initiated by the people. The people are the king. We are the king. So think about that, and I'm very thankful that you got to this point in the show. Thanks for your patience. God bless.
I want out of this. And one other thing, you were talking about Obama.
Yeah.
And we had a guy, the Socialist Party candidate, was taken off the ballot in the state of Washington because he was not a natural-born citizen.
No, so because he hadn't reached the age of 35.
Yeah.